Good morning, everyone. My name is Leroy Stumpf, and I chair the E-12 Education Finance Committee and want to welcome all of you here. We have a fairly lengthy agenda, but we're hoping that, just to give you some idea for planning, we're hoping that we can go through the agenda and finish up right around noon. I would invite there's some House members and some other education policy committee members here, and I would invite them to join us at the table to participate in the hearing. And I would also like to thank Senator Salzman for the efforts she put into getting all of us organized and trying to gather information regarding the referendums that took place, and also her staff as well. I appreciate that very much, and I think it's something that obviously all of the districts have a great interest in, and one that I'm hoping that we will gain a little more information and insight in after as we hear the testimony. What we hope to do today, if you see the agenda, is certainly the most important part is to listen as a committee and as legislators to the what took place out there in terms of referendums and get a little more background as to what we should be doing as a legislative body at the state level to assist our schools and our districts in financing our education system. There isn't, maybe staff can help me out, but I don't think there's any other area in state government that's actually spelled out in the Constitution the way funding of education is spelled out. And I've often referred to that over the years, that this is our constitutional requirement, is to be sure that our education system is taken care of. And over the years, it has definitely property taxes have been a large part of our education system. And we have made modifications over the years. And most recently, I think in 2001, we made a huge change, a change where we, as a legislative body at that time, said that we were going to pay for 100% of our education formula from the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota was going to pay for 100%. And that was a big undertaking, a fairly expensive undertaking. And then in 2003, we took the first step backwards. And in 2005, we took another step backwards. And so I think the whole issue of funding our education system is one that's constantly kind of in flux. And we hope that we can glean some information from your referendums, from what happened out there, both the successful ones as well as those that were not successful, and start looking toward an agenda that we can sell our colleagues on in the legislature and sell the public on as to what we should do in terms of financing public education across the state. So to start out with, I'd like to ask our fiscal person, Mr. Eric Naumann, to go through some information that he's assembled, and then I'd like to ask Senator Saxhog and Senator Olson to join, to be the first ones with the superintendents from Grand Rapids, Bemidji, and those two areas, and Brainerd, I believe, to present what's happened in their districts. Mr. Naumann.
Mr. Chairman and members, good to see all of you again. It's been a while. Representative Gronick.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, I wish I could claim credit for all these data. I plagiarized freely from the Department of Education, but they put together a rather extensive post-election operating referendum document that I've stolen for the purposes of this meeting. I think that it effectively goes through the data better than I could compile it. So I'm looking at this legal-sized document, and I'll just walk you through the pages to the extent that you want to explore questions on this. I'll do so, but I know you have a lengthy agenda, so I'll try to get through it fairly quickly. The first page listed is projected FY09 operating referendum with columns A through F.
Excuse me, Mr. Nolan. Do all the committee members have that?
No.
Okay.
I think it might have been in the packet with for members that were.
Now we do things.
Okay.
Okay, it's coming.
If we'll try to get some more copies so that if you don't have one, okay, we'll get you one. Mr. Nolan.
So Mr. Chairman, the first page attempts to reconcile where we were relative to the end of session projections. Members that sit on this division as well as other committees are familiar with the notion that we build into our budget some assumptions about what passage rates will be on the referendum. We don't do passage rates per se, but the Department of Education makes some assumptions about how much revenue will accrue to districts as a result of future elections. And column A shows what our end of projection total was for total referendum levy, equalization aid, and the tax base replacement line. If there had been no elections, there would have been $539 million of revenue. I'm now on column B, with a potential passage of $785 million. After the actual elections, there were $703.9. So the potential increase was $246, but the actual increase was only $164. So you can see that we were slightly under what we had projected at the end of the year. Given the nebulous nature of this, some years we've been off substantially more than this, and I think that this is probably a pretty good one this year. So, Mr. Chairman and members, flipping to the next page, the second page I won't spend too much time on. It's second and third page. They jump over to the next one. This is listed as election summary number one. And it tracks over a number of years, beginning in calendar year 2000. So that would be the elections for 2000. Most of the referenda that were on the ballot that year would become effective in fiscal year 2002. And I'll just use that as an example to walk you through the data. Line number one, there were 71 questions on the ballot that year, 47 of which passed for a passage rate of 66.2%. Districts with at least one question, there were 70, and 46 passed. This was beginning of the trend where school districts had, as they frequently do now, more than one question on the ballot. You'll note in the next year, this was the big year following the general education levy buyout, there were 207 questions on the ballot, 136 of which passed, and 197 questions. This year, we had 130 questions. I'm now on the very last column. 130 questions, 76 of which passed for a 58.5% passage rate. So I'll flip you to the next page because I think this is this. Now I'm actually flipping you two pages. We can go through that data if you want to, but I think you've got a long agenda, so we won't spend too much time with it. The next page, I think, is interesting because it parses the data slightly differently. This is a traditional way of looking at groups of districts. So we start with Minneapolis-St. Paul, then other metro districts, then non-metro districts with ADM greater than 200. ADM is a weighting of pupil counts. Non-metro ADM from 1,000 to 2,000, and then we scale them at different weights of pupil. This allows us to see groupings of districts that would logically be put in a similar bucket. Minneapolis and St. Paul had no elections in this past year. And again, now what we're looking at is just this year's this election. So we're narrowing the scope down to just this past election. There were 31 questions on the ballot in other metro districts, 17 of which passed. That passage rate, 58.4%. lags slightly behind the state average. the non-metro, and this is where I think one of the interesting stories from this past election was, non-metro ADM greater than 2,000 had 30 questions, only 10 of which passed. So that's about 33.3%. That's exactly 33.3% passage rate, substantially below the statewide average. Now, the non-metro less than 2,000, all of those exceeded these statewide passage rates. Not necessarily intuitive, because many of those districts we tend to think of as less than wealthy property-wise. So that I thought was an interesting notion. Lines 4, 5, and 6 then take those data you have the aid levy and total revenue before elections in each of those groupings, aid and levy and total revenue post-elections, and then you can see the revenue on added by the 07 elections, and then you get some percentages. Mr. Chairman, I think you did want me to highlight, as we flip over to the next page, lines 22, 23, and 24, because here you can begin to see before elections and post-elections, as well as the amount added by the elections, those levies converted into a tax rate. I think this committee has spent a fair amount of time in the last 4 years or so thinking about rates. So what you're doing here is taking your property tax and dividing it into your tax capacity to convert that into a rate, and then thinking about tax rate equity. So I think what you can see here is that some districts are having, as a result of the elections, are choosing to mount a higher rate or carry a higher burden than other districts who passed would have had to do. Then on the final lines, 25 through 27, you can see that the levy changes converted into an amount of burden per $100,000 of referendum market value. This is a traditional way of measuring the effect on an individual homeowner per $100,000 of referendum market value. That was a lot to digest, but that's I think a useful page to digest the to summarize the election. Then the next three or four pages, Mr. Chairman and members, are the actual elections by district. So if your district doesn't appear on here, it's because there was no election. And again, I mentioned earlier that some districts appear more than once because they had more than one question. So beginning with Anoka Hennepin, I'll work you across the columns. First, you have just a number of counting, a district number. Then you get the district name and the date of the election. In most cases, this is going to be November 6th. The gross dollar amount per pupil unit that was requested, any amount that was revoked. On some occasions, districts will choose to revoke during the question some amount of authority that already existed. So you then can calculate a net amount. So looking down at, I think, the first one that falls into that case was Mankato. There on the ballot, they had $639.6 per pupil unit. They revoked $444.6 and were asking to add $195. Remember, see that? What I'm talking through. Mm-hmm. Then the next relevant column is the first year of the payout. In most cases, the referendum question, if passed, would become effective in fiscal year 08, but I think that there are a couple 09s. School districts can't authorize referendum authority for more than 10 years by law, so what we do is we track how many years this particular authority, if passed, would continue for. You can see nothing over 10. Some are choosing 5 and 6, which I think is an interesting trend as well. Given that they can go out for a total of 10 years, some are choosing to do less, which I think is interesting. Then any pre-existing authority, and school districts can also do adjustments for the cost of living. So those calculations are made. But I think what's probably most interesting is how many of them passed. So now we're looking at yes votes, no votes. That's columns K and L. The easy cheating way is to look whether there's under column 1 a 1. Under column M. If there's a 1, it passed. If there's a 0, it didn't. It's a fairly simple. You don't even have to do the math. So I like doing it that way. So that gets you through all the districts. And, again, we had about 130 questions on the ballot. And then the final page, and then I will turn it over to the balance of your agenda, is a summary of trends. We had some trends earlier, but this takes us back a little bit further. About halfway down the page, in the very first column, it says election totals, calendar year, going back through 1991, number of attempts, number of successes, and then the percentages. And if we've done our math correctly, the percentages here will tie back to the ones on the first page. And you can see that last year, in 2006, we had our lowest percent passage rate, 38.4, and I think that was an interesting feature as well. This year, we bounced back up to 58.5. Also interesting, 2001, when we had 207 attempts and 136 passage rates, that was probably our largest number of questions on the ballot, and I think was largely a function of the legislation that was passed in that year, where we did the general education buyout. It created a convergence of three events where the legislature increased equalization at the same time it was buying out general education and transferring $415 of authority from the referendum to the general education formula allowance. So districts could rightly claim to in many cases that passage of this authority would not increase property taxes. Maybe not all of the truth, but not untruthful either. So I think that was an interesting convergence. Then I think the last point that I will make takes a look at revenue total trends. I'm now looking at the line, the column maybe third from the right, where it says revenue. Going back to 1986, we had $87.7 million of revenue in this is both this at that point was all property tax. In 1993, we began to add state aid to the mix, and you can see that coming online under equalization aid, maybe half that column halfway across the page. In 2002 was a 2002 was a high point on revenue, 544, up to a point. Then it drops down to 294, and that is a function of the 415 buyout. And the $500 million was, at that point, rationale for the legislature to say, hey, we're using the referendum too much to finance schools, and we need to transfer some of it over. I think there was a majority that felt that that was a worthwhile rationale. So over 500 at that point was a benchmark for saying we're using the operating referendum too much. Now members will look down on 2009 and note that we're now at 703.9. I'm not drawing any conclusions about that, but just more of a historical trend. So, Mr. Chairman, unless there's questions, I'll leave it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Nauman. In reference to the year of the buyout and the $415 buyout of referendum, have you ever done an analysis of the behavior of districts after that point, because for the $415 buyout in some cases actually added $415 of revenue for that district, and depending on right. the amount of referendum they had, there was a kind of a sliding scale down, and many districts that had more than that got no additional revenue as a result of that. And I wonder if there's any correlation or connection between the enhanced revenue overall for districts and their behavior in succeeding years of needing to go for referendum. Do you ever analyze that?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think the best we could do, I haven't analyzed it that way per se, but maybe we should. I think that we could come up with anecdotal evidence that says, I think under what's presumed in your question is that maybe districts that received hypothetically, $415 of new revenue were less likely to go out for referendum. That's the premise, right?
Yeah, and the other one would be also looking at the extent to which equalization is available in relation to these. Because it seems to me in some cases, even where we have high equalization, they've had difficulty in passing the referendum, even though the state would be picking up most of that tab. It would be interesting to look at those two. I don't expect the answer today or even tomorrow, but if there's in your spare time, if you wouldn't mind seeing whether it's possible to analyze, that would be, I think, could be helpful, especially if it leads to our needing to change policy in what direction we might want to go.
I'll certainly take a look at that. There are 67 individuals in this building that have a say about my spare time, but I think that's a good that's a good idea. But since you brought up the notion, I'll ask you.
I thought you worked for all of us.
I count all 67.
No, I'm kidding.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I will ask you to take a look at the equalization aid column. This doesn't get to your question per se, but I do think it's also an interesting trend. In 2002, we had $178.4 million of equalization aid. This does kind of get at your question about the effects of equalization. The equalization then dropped kind of off the table, so to speak, down to $59.4 million, and then grew up to about $109 in 06. We haven't done much enhancement on equalization since that time period. And again, I'm not advocating one way or the other. But the growth in property tax values began to be seen inside the education formulas at about that time, where we've now seen a trend of a downward slide in equalization, dropping now down to $72 million. At the same time, we're seeing increased revenue. So what that means is that the property tax side is going up. And I think maybe that's why you've got a lot of people here to talk to you about it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman, it is a complicated thing, but in some respects, when we took the 415 over, we actually saved some money of equalization, because some of those $415, if they had referendum, might have been equalized. So that could have been a part of the factor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, actually we did not save that money, because what that did was reduce the price of that $415 on the formula. Because we transferred it over to the formula. So we recaptured that aid savings and used that to offset what would have normally been roughly $415 million impact on the formula.
Right. Well, I understand that. We obviously didn't keep it, but it was money that didn't have to be spent for that particular purpose.
Right.
Any other questions that members have? I think what we'll do is we'll get into the testimony, and I'd like to ask Senator Saxhog and Superintendent, and then also Senator Olson, we'll move one more chair in there and join them.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to thank Senator Olson for helping me put this distinguished group of superintendents together.
Senator Olson, why don't you just, let's see if we can get another chair.
Sounds good.
Slide up there. Since we'll be talking about your districts as well. Thank you. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having this hearing today. As you know, we had quite a number of failed levy referenda in early November, and many of those that referenda that did pass really were there just to keep the doors of some schools open. That wasn't my understanding on why we passed this levy referenda bill in the early 70s. That was to take care of the extras, and that's what I thought this was all about. But we're here today to tell some thoughts. We have three superintendents of school districts in north central Minnesota: Brainerd, Bemidji, and Grand Rapids. All three of these cities are regional centers, and all three of them had failed referenda. With me today are Dr. Jim Hess from Bemidji Independent School District 31, Dr. Jerry Walseth from Brainerd Independent School District 181, and Joe Silko from Grand Rapids Independent School District 318. I have one little anecdote that I'm going to relate, and many of you probably remember this from last year when Dr. Walseth's business manager testified before our committee. And I remember his words. He said, you know, if we pass this referenda next fall, we're going to be just fine. Well, they didn't pass the referenda, And we'll let Dr. Walseth relate what's happened. But the first person we're going to have give some testimony here is Joe Silko from Grand Rapids.
Thank you, Senator Saxhog. Superintendent?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and esteemed members of this Senate committee. 3 weeks ago, the voters in the community of Grand Rapids went to the polls to decide on an operating levy requested by our school. They went, like the voters in almost 100 other school districts, to decide the educational fate of the children. Some of these votes in these districts were, these voters were deciding whether to sustain current programming, reduce class sizes, and some were simply asked, can we survive? In my opinion, and in the opinion of many others like me in the educational arena, and I assume most of you, this voter roulette, as I've heard it called, is no way to fund education. The over-reliance on property taxes has created a system that is broken. It's created a system that says it's okay for a child in Minnetonka or Edina to have an education $1,820 more than a child in Grand Rapids, simply because I cannot get a referendum passed. When I look at a first grade child from Minnetonka and from Grand Rapids, I believe they deserve the same education, not differing educations. The regional center demographics that we have are very unique. We have declining populations of school-age children, but a rising overall population, which is signifying that we have a disconnect happening with our schools. We have a population of people that aren't that connected with the school. We have taken that declining enrollment, and we've taken the charge seriously. If you look at, I forget what the exact line it is for the Grand Rapids data, but we are one of those small percentage of districts, less than 10% in the state of Minnesota, that has no operating levy in place right now. We are simply asking for what we considered a small $295 per pupil operating levy, and it failed with no organized resistance, no organized resistance, very few letters to the editor, 2-1, 2-1. In an issue, a single issue, single question, we should have had about 2,500 voters. We had over 6,300 voters come out. 6,300 voters with no organized opposition. They came out to say no to taxes. They came out to say no to this over-reliance on property tax. We're a very rich seasonal rec property district. And the fact that seasonal rec property is not included in operational levies puts a disproportionate burden on our residential homeowners. It's too much. And they kicked back very strongly and said no. We've done our job with the declining enrollment. We've quietly taken off of an approximately $43 million budget. We've reduced over $7 million in the last 7 years. We think we've been fiscally responsible. We've eliminated 56 teaching positions alone. We've raised class sizes, but besides that, scores of others in the support roles. We've raised class sizes to 32 in our elementaries and approximately 40 in our high school in our core area courses. We believe that we've done what we needed to do to balance the budget. We asked our voters for more, and they said no. And we raised with a very strong no. I have no magic bullet in my pocket which could swing 2,000 voters on a 6,000 vote issue the other way by running this again. I applaud you as committee members for your efforts on behalf of education. Senator Bonoff, in particular, has a difficult task ahead as she co-chairs this House Senate Finance Reform Task Force. I just want you to know that we in Grand Rapids will go back, we'll continue to dismantle our schools further, which we must do. The voters have spoken. But we want you to know that our children And us as a community need your continued outstanding efforts on their behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silko.
Mr. Chair, do you want to take questions?
Oh, sure, sure. Senator Anderson.
Just briefly, Superintendent Silko, can you tell us briefly what the impact's going to be? I mean, what are the cuts that you're going to be having to make now? Do you know yet?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we are going to eliminate, we've already closed two elementary schools. We're going to close one more, our most rural school up in Squaw Lake, Minnesota. Will be closed this spring. We are going to raise our class sizes beyond where they're at now. I'm roughly predicting another two students per class, so our elementaries will probably go to 34 and into the low 40s in our high school.
Let's see. Okay. A question I had is, and I think I'm on page, let's see, one.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. There aren't pages. I think
four.
You want
page
summary.
Four, yeah. Up in the left-hand corner, it says election summary, too. Does Grand Rapids fall in that Category 3, the non-metro ADM greater than 2,000?
Yes.
Okay. I guess the question that goes through my mind is, when you look at the percentage of success in that class area, it's like about a half compared to most of the other ones, and that's, you know, that's a puzzler. I don't know why, because here you have Grand Rapids, Brainerd, Bemidji, all about, you know, I'm not sure the exact size, but similar kinds of cities.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we part of that is again that disconnect. Our populations come to us for health care and shopping, not bringing school-age children. And most of them come from other smaller communities in our area and have, frankly, an allegiance to their former smaller community where they were born and raised, more than they have with the schools in their own community, the community now where they live.
Okay. Okay, maybe we can decipher a little bit more below the surface on what's going on. But I think all districts across the state are having the same problem with the property tax. I mean, whether it's, you know, that group or size of cities or communities, or whether it's, you know, some other. It seems to me like that's a general, you know, kind of a feeling out there, unfortunately, the response came out in that category or group of cities. So it'd be interesting to kind of, as we start piecing this all together. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Superintendent Silko. We do take our task force very seriously, and we know that we have big challenges ahead. And so we have members, you know, Chair Greiling is here also of that task force to listen to these concerns. But one of the concerns we have as a task force is making sure that every student in this state has the same excellent opportunities. And so as you make your cuts, I'm curious about what's happening with course offerings. How about foreign language? How about AP classes? Are you still able to offer those kinds of programs?
We are an IB, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, we are an IB school, so we have IB in our high school rather than AP. We have reduced the numbers of course offerings that we have there, and we also have we've reduced offerings all across our all across the board in the numbers of electives that students are able to have. So it does impact that significantly as well.
Thank you.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Superintendent Silko, for coming and testifying. I wanted to just ask a couple of questions, but prompted by your testimony. You said that, and you described that in your community, that there isn't a strong connection between the people who live there and the schools, that you described people moving there that may have a stronger allegiance to schools where they grew up, but there's not that that sense that the schools in their community are their schools, and so maybe that was part of the reason why the vote turned out the way it did. I don't know. I don't know if anybody really knows what the reason was. But and you also talked about the problem with the property tax structure, and I appreciate that. I think that is a perennial issue that we've talked about in various ways. Are people saying, in your estimation, that they would rather have higher income taxes than property taxes? Or if there's a sense that there's more money that's needed for schools and the local people are not willing to tax themselves on property taxes, who are they thinking should pay the funds to increase the funding to the schools? Is that clear? Is that part of the message, that they're opting for more income taxation that is coming from other places? Or what is the answer? What is the funding source that they're expecting to support the schools?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hanna, I would say that it would be conjecture on my part, but I would say we need a much broader funding, much broader tax base that gives to all children on an equal basis. I certainly believe personally that we need more revenue in the system. We need to keep up with the costs of education, and I believe we need more revenue in the system to do that. It's pure conjecture, but I think a broader-based tax structure for all children throughout the state, it would be certainly more equitable than those that have versus those that have not.
Okay, Superintendent Hess.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Hess. I'm Superintendent of Schools in Bemidji, and I'd really rather not be here today talking about our failed referendum. There are many other things that I would like to be doing as far as educational leadership than to be talking about a system that seems to have some significant flaws. Bemidji has currently a referendum in place. We have it in place for one more year. 4 years ago, some very caring and concerned and motivated parents took it upon themselves to work their tails off so that we could have a referendum in Bemidji. And they gave blood, sweat, and tears to the effort and worked around the clock. They worked tirelessly. They spoke to every group that would listen to them. And as a result, Bemidji put in place a referendum that I think maximized state participation. We had like a third state funds and then two-thirds local property tax. And that's due to expire next year. And we thought next year with the presidential election that our little referendum campaign might get lost in the shuffle. We're not going to be spending $10 bazillion on posters and television ads and things. And so we thought it would be wise to come out a year early and try to have our referendum approved and extended. We weren't asking for the moon. We asked two questions. One was to renew the current $501 operating levy. The other was for $199 so that we could hire additional counselors in our high school, to have a library media specialist in our middle school. $199 would have paid for some more teachers in our district. All very reasonable, very well thought out requests that came to us from listening sessions that our board held throughout the district. Well, it's a good thing we came out a year early because now it shows us just how much harder we're going to have to work in this next campaign to have any kind of chance of getting this passed. What I'd like to talk to you about are three observations from a superintendent's perspective. First of all, there's a risk of even greater community polarization as a result of these referendums. Secondly, the loss and reductions are real in Bemidji and in other school districts, and you're going to hear about that from people that are going through these horrific activities right now. And then third, the referendums are creating a whole new metaphor for school leaders, and I want to just briefly mention each one of those things. The risk of greater community polarization, we're putting our parents against our senior citizens. We're putting our young against our old, and we're competing hard for resources. My mom's 90 years old, and she said, "Son, if people don't vote for this referendum, don't feel it's that we don't value education. Just feel like we have paid all we can pay. And if it's a choice between keeping our house and having a referendum, we're going to keep our house." Our referendum places property owners that are regular residents against recreational seasonal cabin owners. That doesn't seem fair either. We are going to see increasing community-state polarization as the loss becomes more urgent and campaigners take off the gloves to drive home their positions in the next campaign. We're going to place districts that have referendums in competition with districts that do not have referendums for students, for programs, for recognition, for other kinds of resources. And we're going to see that 5%, 95% disparity rating continue to grow and continue to widen. And that, I think, should be a significant concern for you as legislators when you think about the constitutional duty that we have in Minnesota. Well, the losses and reductions are real. And as I said, our campaign workers gave their blood, and they need a rest. Our parents are tired. When it was time to renew our referendum this year, I talked with a couple parents. In fact, many of our board members talked with parents that led the last effort. And we said, "Would you be willing to come up here and lead again?" And they said, "We're really tired." And they were telling us the truth. And the campaign just takes so much out of people. We're 1 year away from a cliff. We're going to slow things down right now so that as far as our spending, we're going to be looking for other options along the way, and we're going to be starting a different kind of mentality. Rather than thinking about what we can add, we're going to be thinking about what we can do without in Bemidji. Blaming is without bounds in today's newspaper blogs. Districts have made their case, I think, in many parts. We've had people say there ought to be a vote of no confidence in a superintendent that can't bring home the bacon as far as a referendum campaign. We should have campaigned door to door. This Minnesota Nice concept that I remember has kind of gone right out the window in this. The whole new metaphor that I wanted to talk about, you know, when I went into school teaching and school administration, I went there with the idea that I could build things better, a better tomorrow with the kids of today, and that I could help do things to add, I think, quality to their life experiences as an educator. Now I'm going to have to change from that metaphor to that as a skillful surgeon, and I'm going to be looking at what kind of organ I can extract and do the least amount of harm to the body. Schools have been the great equalizer for many, many years, but right now we've got to pit one organization against another, one child against another, for very precious resources. Superintendents and board members have another metaphor change as well. We are not necessarily going to be thought of as builders of a new and better society. We're going to be thinking of ourselves as marketers and salespeople, and what can we do to make our message resonate among voters so that we can get their approval in the next go-around. So those are some of the things that we're looking at right now. Those are some of the personal observations. The reason that we passed this referendum in Bemidji was to fill in some of the holes that we had from our School Finance Act. We have a significant hole left over after we look at transportation costs. In Bemidji, we have to cross-subsidize transportation by about $400,000 a year. That means I have to take money out of general fund and put it into transportation for a required kind of service. Special ed is another one of those cross subsidies. I have to take $2.5 million out of general fund and pay for special ed costs that are required of us. And then the third thing that I think is a cross subsidy, even though we don't count it or consider it as so, is all day kindergarten. I think in today's world, children need all day kindergarten, and we're cross subsidizing that with our referendum currently. So those are some of the things that are concerning us. Those are some of the things that we're looking at in Bemidji, and we're getting ourselves geared up to look at what we can do to make sure that we have the resources necessary to give our children a great education. So those are my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Our Superintendent Hess. Any questions that members have? And not Superintendent Walz, Seth?
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I, too, want to talk about briefly in three areas. I'd like to provide a little history.
Superintendent, could you maybe move that a little bit closer, and then if you could give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Jerry Walseth, Superintendent of the Brainerd School District, Brainerd, Minnesota. I, too, want to share some information about our district. I want to talk about the historical perspective. I want to talk about the challenge with this referendum, and I want to talk just a moment about the impact or the long-term results. We're the 28th largest school district in the state of Minnesota. We have 7,200 students. We have a stable population that over the past six or seven or even longer years, we've been over 7,000 students. We are a growing recreation area. We are a growing demographically retirement community. We almost double the average of retirement moving into our lakes area. We are a school district of 750 square miles, presently eight elementaries, soon to become six, a large middle school, a ninth grade center, and a high school. The historical records suggest that we have been able to provide quality education to our students, that we have been recognized by Standards and Poor as one of the 10 outstanding districts in this state for 4 years in a row, outperforming peers based on the money that we've had. Newsweek magazine, I know that you're familiar with that poll based upon AP. We've been in that top 5% every year that's existed. NCLB has identified blue ribbon schools. We have three blue ribbon school elementaries. And so by outside standards, there's been a quality of success. In this particular election, it was that quality versus taxes was the issue. If in the polls people had been able to rate our schools 1 through 10, 10 being extremely high, 1 being extremely low, I'm guessing 80 to 90% of our folks would have been rating us in the 7 or higher bracket. But it wasn't. It was a yes or no vote. And a normal election in our district might generate 2,800 voters. This election generated 60% of the population. We had over 14,000 voters. We had the largest yes vote in the history of education to support our referendum. We had the support of the Chamber of Commerce, of Brainerd Lakes Area Development Corporation, numerous parents groups, and we went down by 3,000 votes. The impact of what we're experiencing is genuine and much more far-reaching in the classroom. You've heard it alluded to by the other superintendents, what's happening in their communities. What's happening in ours is that polarization. Camps have been clearly defined, and now we are dismantling an organization that over 5,400 yes voters supported. People who voted no have the money in their pockets, and folks who vote yes are going to have a direct impact on the education of their children. There are many reasons that our taxpayers voted no, and regardless of those reasons, it was a mandate for us to take action, and take action we will. But some of those reasons include we couldn't afford it, and that is true. Another group, however, could afford it and voted no because their time to support education had passed. Every school district in this state has roughly a third of its patrons having children in school. That means we have to convince a large body that is disconnected from the daily operations of school. That didn't happen in a large retirement community. We have others who voted no because they said this is a state problem. They didn't tell us how the state should fix it, but they said it's a state problem. We have had the AP Scholars of the Year, both male and female, in our school district within the last 3 years. We will no longer be a comprehensive program. We, in 2003, Senator, you mentioned a significant event. It was a significant event, and it launched the beginning of our downfall. We had 508 teachers in 2003. We have 466 presently, of which approximately 125 are special ed. And by the end of this school year, we will have 400 or less teachers employed. We have over 15% special ed population. In the past, we've had a cross-subsidy of $3.1 million coming out of our general fund to support that. Thanks to your effort, we have some relief, temporary though it may be, of $1 million. Had those things been in place, we wouldn't have had a referendum. And on top of that, we happen to be in that retirement community, highly seasonal, recreational, laden. 20 to 25% of our tax base happens to fit that category. So 75% of the remaining tax base must support the operations of schools when it went to ask. Let me share with you what those state tax dollars. We have a $199 referendum in place that was in place in 2001. So consequently, we can say that the state tax dollars are supporting our school district. Starting in the fall of 2008, the system that you have helped us create will have high 20s in our elementary schools in the very fundamental part of learning. We will have middle 30s in our middle school, and we will have high 30s to low 40s in our high school. Because of the state mandates, we will maintain our core. What goes away are those things that cause us to be recognized for what we are, the APs and the other elective courses. It is time for action, and the action that our district must take is to decimate a quality system. And we have begun that process, and we will complete that process this year. We are not a year away from the cliff. We have gone over it. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I most certainly am not alone in the message that could be shared. We have turned into a professional referendum community to support kids. Somehow, in my mind's eye, regardless of what the solutions are, we can't get there alone educationally. There has to be partnerships. There have to be other ways to come at this, because this system is not going to continue to develop quality education. And we will also be challenged with a system that we've had to recreate in 10 years when we're asked, why are our students not performing as well as others? Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Great. thank you very much, Mr. Superintendent Walsa. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to say a couple of words to reinforce what the superintendents have said. I'd first like to thank all the members of this committee for taking the time to hold this hearing, and I'd especially like to thank Senator Saxhog for his efforts in putting together this group to come down from North Central Minnesota, and for inviting me to be here. My observations are very consistent with what the senators have or what the superintendents have said. I realize there are challenges all over the state and both in rural and the metro area of the state in terms of passing referendums. But in North Central Minnesota, I think for your information, at least my perspective as to some of the unique challenges we face, is that we are a destination area for senior citizens, for the retirement population. And that population is welcome in our area and very important to the economy of our area. So it's not as though we want to not invite those people into our communities, but they really do present us with some unique challenges in terms of funding school districts. As has been pointed out, some of them are only part-time residents, and they're not contributing to the operational funds, the operational costs of school districts. They're also buying very high-value properties. They tend to be wealthier people. In the northern part of my district, the average family of four makes less than $30,000. We've seen a lot of layoffs in the logging industry in particular throughout our area, and people's wages are falling behind the cost of their property taxes, so we can't afford more pressure on property taxes. Corresponding with that, we have the need for increased public services that go along with with poverty issues. And so we're seeing, in my opinion, a negative spiral that's going to accelerate if we don't do something to turn this around and make sure that we are funding education equally across the state so that no matter where someone lives, they have the opportunity, a family has the opportunity to want to live there and see that their children are well educated. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Senator Saltzman was ahead of me, but
okay. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. I just want to thank you so much for being here because we hear so much about the metro area, but some of the numbers that, like, we haven't looked at today are employment rates, job loss, and we're going to have to squeeze as much talent out of every child in this state if we're going to continue to have, you know, prosperity that we have known in this state. So I think to thank you for your efforts, but the two words that are most disturbing to me are dismantling and disseminating, and excuse me, decimate. Dismantling programs. If you would, Superintendent Walseth, maybe if you have to dismantle a program, how long would it take you to restore that program in the future?
Superintendent Walseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. Let me give you an example. All day, every day, kindergarten. We have stretched our dollars to provide all day, every day in six of our eight buildings. We couldn't provide it in our two most affluent. One of the significant decisions will be to roll back all day, every day kindergarten and start from ground zero. So what I'll tell you is those folks who miss that opportunity miss it for a lifetime. To put the program back into effect and to maintain, we have a 96% teacher retention rate in our district. To go back and get the quality and to build in the staff development, assuming that we have the same kind of quality in the background within 3 to 4 years. A lot of the programs, no matter how hard we try, we could never bring back.
Thank you very much.
Senator Olson. And
then thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to sound defensive, but I frankly, as one who is not a fan of the property tax, I will declare that right up front. Is that our several comments have been made relative to even some of our suburban schools that have high property values. Many of these, you're going to hear from some of them, but many of these districts are ones that are also kind of fighting to retain some mixture in our socioeconomic groups. And people can afford to come in and buy expensive land, tear down nice houses to build bigger ones. But the ones who've lived there all their life and would, as we're trying, many of our seniors would like to stay there. me being one. You'd like to live where you, an area that you've enjoyed. But Superintendent Walsh mentioned about if you vote no, you keep money in your pocket. Part of the challenge with the property tax is that, quote, wealth of the property is not in your pocket until you sell your land or your home. And that's, I think, therein lies the jeopardy of it. And even though sometimes we in the educational community or the entities that get their funds from the property tax like it because it's the most stable tax, it means only that the stability comes from if you don't pay it, you lose your property. And so it that's why it is both hated and very difficult. And I do hope that we can find a better way of supporting our, you know, even though that also carries the mantra of local control, you know, people being able to have a say. But we're living in some very dynamic, changing times that are also very challenging. And the challenges are not just in the rural area, they're in the metro area. I know, you know, talking about the seasonal rec homes, you know, we went through the whole thing of these people can't vote.
Oh, yeah.
And yet they're paying for this. And there were ways of trying to find some way of modifying that so that we weren't forcing, again, people just with cabins, not just the ones that can come up and build a McMansion up on the lake. And, I mean, it is a very challenging time. And I hope that we're not going to solve it all in the education committee. We need help from the tax committee of recognizing that, you know, while there's a desire to hang on to taxing wealth, wealth that you don't have access to, it means that you're forcing people to make decisions by our tax policy, decisions that they do not want to make and shouldn't have to.
Senator Olson, you bring up a good point that we're going to be working very closely with, I think, the tax committee, and to try to put all the pieces together, it's going to take several committees, I think, to try to come up with a good answer or a good solution. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me sit in with you. I'm on the Education Policy Committee, not the Finance Committee. But I do want, excuse me, to speak to a point that Senator Olson started to suggest, and I think Senator Stumpf, I just heard you suggest a little bit towards that too, and that is the fact that here at the Capitol, when we're dealing with education issues or tax issues or whatever, we tend to work in silos, and we have to really move away from that towards solving the state of Minnesota's problems altogether, reaching from one department across to the next. And I think in education we really understand that because we know that when a child comes to school hungry, they're not going to be able to learn as well. So there's some family implications. And so we know that funding education is not simply funding education. It's many, many other things. Excuse me. I'd like to know from you just as a generalization and other testifiers as they come up, to what extent healthcare costs are impacting your school districts. I sit on both of the healthcare committees. Senator Olson is on the healthcare committee, and I don't know if anyone else here except Representative Bunn is on healthcare. But this is another place where we have to talk to each other. Education, healthcare have to talk to each other, as well as the tax committee. Because if healthcare costs were taken off the education plate, I would imagine none of you would be here today. And we have to solve the healthcare cost crisis in Minnesota together because it's killing education.
Senator.
And so I would just put that out there that we need to continue to have groups working and articulating in solving these problems together.
I'm not sure we have enough time to try to get that answer today, but I do agree. We actually tried very hard in the education bill to relieve some of the pressure through this better funding in the special education area. And I, for one, believe that the total special ed ought to be our responsibility, ought to be picked up. But I think And that's definitely related to health care. I mean, that's a good portion of it. But I think, Senator Hand, and then very quickly we'll move into our next. We have a long, long list here. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't think my question will be too lengthy, but appreciate your testimony, Mr. Walsa. Just a question for you. Given the dynamics of what you described, and as we're wrestling with, as Senator Olson has indicated, this is a problem. It is troubling, and I don't think any of us are big fans of the way we currently do property taxation. But there has always been this thought that when you have local participation in decisions about education, not only in the financial but on the policy and operational side, that that is a good thing, that you want that connection with families and constituents and schools. So if what we're seeing here, even though we have right now, I think we're one of the highest states in the country in terms of percentage of money being for education coming from state resources rather than local resources, and we've gone further down that path over the years, would you be in favor of 100% of funding coming from state sources? And if so, what does that mean for, do we need school boards then? Are we looking at centralizing administration and so forth? I mean, how do you retain the local connection to schools if all the decisions about funding and policy are made in St. Paul? But I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. You don't favor that. But I'm just asking, would you rather see the education funding be 100% from the state and nothing from the local level? Or what is your thought on that?
Before you, Superintendent, before you answer that very in a very succinct question, I'd like to recognize Senator Bach, who chairs the Tax Committee, is here as well. And I know we worked very closely last year to try to wrestle with some of these kind of multifaceted issues. So welcome. It's very circular. Superintendent, I'll see, who was that directed to? Superintendent Walseth, I believe. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator, what I would appreciate is a system that identified the expectations that they have of students, set the standards, hold us accountable, and fund it 100%.
Okay. Thank you. And now I'd like to call on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. We appreciate it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
I know it's a long trip, but we appreciate your input. I'd like to call on Pat Welter, Peter Hammerlink, and Carol Hamilton. If they would come up. And as I'm watching the clock, if you can keep your testimony very, very much to the point, that would be great. Who's going to lead off? Pat Welter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Welter. This is Peter Hammerlink, and this is Carol Hamilton. And we are here representing a group called Neighbors for School Excellence, which is a group of parents and community members who were formed to support the St. Cloud Area School District, which, by the way, is also a regional center in central Minnesota. We worked to help pass an operations levy for basic services in 2003. We were one of those districts mentioned earlier in 2001 the referendums were bought out that received no additional funding. And so in 2003, we had a operations levy to have basic services maintained. In 2006, we worked to help pass a bond levy to build a new school. And this year, our 2003 basic services operations levy was expiring. So we again worked to pass another operations levy to replace it. This levy failed, and we're now faced with losing about $4.7 million at the end of the school year. To us, this is beginning to feel like an endless, never-ending cycle to provide the basics. And we're not talking about any enriched or special services. We're not talking about any high-end technology. We are really talking about the essentials. What we'd like to do is just talk a little bit about the levy and our efforts and what we did and some challenges we faced. In our levy, we had two questions. The first question simply asked to renew the 2003 levy. Now, what that meant was we were going to maintain class sizes. We were not going to decrease them. We're maintaining class sizes. We're going to maintain kindergarten at every day, half day. We don't have every day, whole day. We never had. Before we had passed the 2003 levy, we had every other day, whole day, because we couldn't afford the transportation cost of every day, half day. We want to maintain the one-mile transportation. We used to have 2 miles transportation limit. So this levy wanted to maintain that. We wanted to restore our fund balance, maintain our restoration of our fund balance. The 2003 levy, we had zero fund balance. We were actually deficit spending. We wanted to maintain junior high activities. We actually had to eliminate junior high activities prior to 2003. This levy in 2007 would simply maintain those activities. We contend that these are basic services. They're not special enrichments. The second question asked voters to invest in improved technology, which is far behind the needs in our area. Both of those levy questions would have cost an average homeowner in our area an additional $20 a year. The cost of the two questions together is below the state average referendum amount, and ours was among the smallest asked for increase in the state. Now, I want to talk a little bit about our committee's efforts. The committee, the district leadership, the community efforts were absolutely enormous. It was like running a political campaign, and I've managed a political campaign, so I know what that's like. We had a steering committee. We gave presentations, over 30, throughout the community. We had targeted mailings. We had phone banks, weeks and weeks of phone banks. We had lit drops. We had signage throughout the community. We had paid for and free media. We engaged our public officials, all our four area legislators, Democrats and Republicans, the Chamber and Trades and Labor all publicly supported this levy. Colleges and university students were with us, and we worked with them to try to get the vote out at those places. And we had a fundraising effort similar to House of Representative races. And still, we lost hundreds and hundreds of hours, hundreds of volunteers, thousands of dollars that we raised to ask people to spend $20 a year for basic educational services. Peter was in charge of the phone banks, and he's going to just talk a little bit about what that felt like.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. If you could just state
your name for the record.
Please. Peter Hammerlink, I'm a parent within District 742 St. Cloud.
Thank you.
What we found through the phone banks is folks who we typically thought were going to be very supportive of our efforts, of our supportive education, and they would tell us that. And in the same breath, they'd also say, but you know what, I can't vote for it. They would essentially say that there's got to be a point where this type of activity, this type of funding has to stop. And we would try to convince them. We would have school board members. We had our superintendent on the phone talking to folks who were no's and undecideds. But people were just to the point of being basically fed up with the way we were operating the system. And so night after night on the phones, we had successes, but we also had kind of a core growing group of people who just over the years have become really not satisfied with the reliance on how we're funding education. Thank you.
Carol was one of the presenters in the community, and she's going to talk about some of her experiences.
If you could give your name for the record,
please. My name is Carol Hamilton. My children went through the St. Cloud Public School Systems, and I am a retired teacher. Last year, I worked very hard at coming down to the legislature and talking about the cross-subsidy that we have as a regional center in St. Cloud. This year, my energies really went to working on the levy committee. And I was one of the community members who went out with school board members to give presentations whenever we were asked within the community. We gave approximately 30 hour and a half to anywhere to 5 hour type presentations to community members. We were at PTA meetings. We were at site council meetings. We talked to the League of Women Voters. I also helped man some of the phone banks. So a lot of my time and energies this fall went into, as did those of other people, hoping that this levy was going to pass, because we knew the impact and the cuts, if it didn't pass, were going to be fairly extreme for our area. And over again, the kinds of comments that we were getting from people were, you know what, isn't the state supposed to be providing for this? Why are you coming out for an operating levy? We have a high private school population. We have a lot of families who daycare may be in the next community, and they may do open enrollment for their children. We have a high special ed population because we are a regional medical center. And so those children may not go to private school. They may come to our public school. So our percentage of children who have higher needs are higher than it is in some of the other surrounding areas. You know, when the levy didn't pass by such a small amount, I think we all, it was like being hit in the gut. We were really, really disheartened. And then the next question was, okay, can you do it again? Because we still have to go back. And it is like a political campaign. You know, we do mailers, we do flyers, we do phone contact, we do a broad range of contacts. We try to educate the population about, you know, what the state's responsible for, why there's such an impact on our local property taxes, and yet we need to make sure that we can fund that those educational opportunities for all of our children. And it's stressful. And I don't think that it's something that we should be doing year after year after year after year. And depending on where you live, it's now becoming, well, if your levy passed, you're the one who didn't pass, it must be something wrong with your campaign. We've gotten to the point where that's the criteria for whether or not we have money to fund our education for our children. It's very, very frustrating.
Thanks, Carol. Could you just comment when you have this question on the ballot and about raising taxes, and in particular property taxes, there's usually it's not just a school district that's raising taxes, it's also the city and the county and right. other special taxing districts as well. So the focus of higher property taxes is also the result of other entities, do you think that that's part of the frustration that the public is having?
Yes, in fact, that was one of the challenges we were going to talk about. The city of St. Cloud raised taxes by 27%, and that was announced just a relatively short time before the vote this fall. And that was a huge issue that we kept hearing over and over and over again. Another challenge that we found related to that is that the wording on those ballots on the levy question is there, and it's by state law, and it's very, very difficult for people to understand. We had various committees look at the wording. We had our attorneys look at the wording of those levy questions, and I think we had discretion over five words out of many, and they were not clear, and they were very confusing to people. Some other challenges that we had is that in our area, in addition to the city of St. Cloud, we have our district encompasses over 17 townships and other cities, and each of those areas has some of their own unique needs. Some of them are retirement areas, and so the same kind of thing that you've heard about folks who are on fixed incomes, we kept hearing. Some of those areas are rural, and they don't identify with St. Cloud, and they tend to vote no on any levy that the school district has. Another challenge that we had is that because we're nestled so closely to other school districts, what's happening in those other school districts, some of whom were also running levy campaigns, impacted us. For example, there was a negative campaign going on in another school district right next to ours, attacking the superintendent. We heard over and over in our phone banks, well, you know, thinking that it was our superintendent they were attacking, what's wrong with your administration? What's wrong with your superintendent? The school district neighboring to ours announced right before the vote a teacher's settlement. So, of course, that became a thing that we heard over and over, a negative criticism the last few days to when we were calling to get out the vote. The point I'm trying to make is that it was, in a sense, it was haphazard, it was random, it was sort of like these things kept popping up. They weren't related to the quality of the school district. They weren't related to the kind of campaign we were running. It was almost like the luck of the draw, in a sense.
Okay.
You know, our parents and our community members are really proud to participate in contributing towards public education. Our theme was keep a good thing going. We tried to run a very positive campaign, and year after year for the last 4 or 5 years, we've been participating in this. But our levy was defeated by 160 votes out of over 14,000 votes. And we're going to lose $4.7 million as a result. This was money, as we said before, not for enrichment, not for reform, not for creative innovation, not for high-end technology. It was for essentials. Something is wrong. Okay. Public education is a constitutional right. Adequate funding by the state is a constitutional mandate. As parents and community members, we're not afraid to step up to the plate and support our public schools, but year after year for basics, for essentials, we don't feel that's our responsibility. That's the responsibility of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was all the testimony so far has been excellent, and I appreciate that. But I do have this long list, and I'm kind of working on my way down, so... thank you. Next, we have Sarah O'Kane from Wadena. And one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11. We have 11 more districts that would like to testify. So, welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Sarah O'Kane, and I am representing the Wadena Deer Creek School District Referendum Steering Committee. I did kind of have a little speech here, but I think I'll skip through some of it, it's not important. But again, you're going to hear so many details of the number of hours. We counted up well over 1,000 hours that was put into our campaign. I could give you examples of our brochure and our palm card. And again, that's not really why we're here. What I'd like to talk to you a little bit about is the impact that I have seen afterwards. Again, our goal was really to run a very positive campaign, and we feel that we did. In all of the meetings that we held, we had two negative comments. There was nothing, there was no letters to the editor, nothing in the newspaper, anything negative. And when the results came in, we were sitting at the restaurant at 10:15 at night, and we got a phone call that we had 671 votes, and we were excited about that. Then we heard that there was 1,277 no votes. We were absolutely floored. We had prepared that, yes, you win, yes, it passes, yes, it doesn't. We were not prepared for that. So along with the disappointment of losing this election, we now have to look at the reasons why. There have been many negative comments given to our committee, the administration, and our teachers. Some of the more common ones are, this was just to give the teachers and administration huge raises. Why should we pay more when we were just told the taxes in the city of Wadena would be going up 20%? Again, like in St. Cloud, that was announced, I believe, about a month before the election. And why is this my problem? I don't have children in the school system. I also received a comment that the steering committee was full of people with money, and the tax increase would not affect us at all. Of the five members of our committee, we have a lawyer, a dentist, a small business owner, and two stay-at-home parents, as I am. I gave my time because of my children, and I gave my time because of the love of my community and the school district. And I don't think that now having to face these personal attacks is necessary. I don't think we should have to deal with it. And again, we're not going to get people to come forward and do this work if this is what we're going to have to do. Many of these comments heard throughout the community have been very hurtful to our staff, our committee members, and to our children. I believe one of the reasons the school district should not have to go to taxpayers, I believe this is one of the reasons why we should not have to go to taxpayers to ask for financial support. Many people donated time and money to have a successful outcome, and we're now left with a disappointment in our community. I'd like to end with just a little personal story. I have three young girls, an 8-, 6-, and 3-year-old. My girls saw how hard I worked and saw very little of me for quite some time. When they would ask me why I was doing all this work, I tried to explain it to them. We talked about what they really liked doing in school. I asked them what their favorite parts of the day were. They came up with quite a few answers, including the music class, Phi Ed, and art. The morning after the election, my oldest daughter, Allison, came to me and asked, "Mom, did we win?" I had to look at her and say, "No, we didn't get enough votes." My 6-year-old daughter, Erin, then looked at me and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, "Mom, do I get to go to art today?" This is the reason why so many parents and community members are working so hard to support their local campaigns. If we did not have to spend the time and energy fighting this battle, think of the time we could spend volunteering in our schools and supporting the efforts of our teachers and staff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was... Senator Salzman.
I just want to thank you for coming down, Ms. Kane, because I know you left yesterday because you emailed me for making a special trip here. Do you have a sense that when you talk to people now that they have any idea of what's going to happen to your schools?
No. You know, I was actually – I have a list here that we have one teacher who's kind of taken charge of within the school district, maybe hearing some of the comments that they have heard or whatnot. And I think I told you this morning, if I had a dollar for every time one person said, "Well, I heard my taxes were going to go up $1,000, I think I could have funded the levy, what we've asked for. My comment to them is, then you have the only $1.5 million home in Wadena County. Because so many people, that's what the information they heard. We had established a website and also on our school website where they could make three clicks and they could find out to the penny the exact dollar amount based on the property value of what they could do. For example, my house was less than $200. And people did not understand that. And so, again... Now we have to look back and figure out what can we do different. In losing in a 2-1, I can't tell you what we could have done different. If we had lost by 50 votes or 100 votes, man, maybe we could have talked to this committee or we could have done this or we could have done this. We're at a loss. And, again, it's our children now that are going to lose, in my opinion. So.
Thank you very much. Senator Roblin?
One additional question about the demographics of your community. Mm-hmm. Age, and are you also recreational?
No, we actually have, within our school district, you're hard-pressed to find a lake. We do have, it's a large farming community, a large retirement community. We encompass basically three cities in Wadena, Deer Creek, and Bluffton. Again, you're going to find a lot of farming communities. One comment that we heard, too, is people didn't understand that they thought that the entire agricultural their property would be taxed at all of that. We spent many, many, many hours putting together the information, and we were so we just basically needed to get the point out that it is, you know, your house, your garage, and 1 acre. And so many people did not understand that. And again, we're looking at ourselves just stumped because it was everywhere. We had posters up, we had this with all this information for people to understand, and they just didn't get the message. And we don't know at this point what else we could have done.
Thank you again. Thank you very much. We have Lisa Sadoff and Judy Keller from Lakeville. Welcome, and if you could give your name for the record. And
good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Lisa Sadoff. I've co-chaired the Citizens Vote Yes Committee in Lakeville for the last two elections, and this is actually Laura Lonergan. She has worked in many capacities on our Vote Yes committees also. On November 6th in Lakeville, voters went to the polls for three levy referendum questions. Number one was a renewal of $571 per pupil unit for the district operating budget for educational basics. Number two was to increase the operating budget by $389 per pupil unit. And question number three was for technology. Number one, the renewal, passed by a landslide, 60-40. We have a recount tomorrow for question number two. It lost by 15 votes. The turnout was about 12,500. And question number three was solidly rejected.
Our committee came together in July to start fundraising and recruiting volunteers. We raised over $20,000. Over 300 volunteers came together and spent months supporting our schools. Lakeville is a community where about 50% of the households have children of school age. A recent survey done by the city found that the number one reason people move to Lakeville is for the schools. Yet we were challenged to overcome objections that fell under one of two umbrella themes: no more taxes, or the school just doesn't spend their money wisely. We left no rock unturned. Vote Yes committee members were at approximately 70 school and community events, football games, lots of different events. 1,300 lawn signs were proudly displayed around Lakeville. Flyers were in news tubes and on windshields. Canvassing calls allowed us to deliver a targeted get out the vote effort. There were postcards, reminder calls, even door knocking. We're happy our voters approved more dollars for our schools than they rejected. But it is unacceptable that our district is still faced with over $6 million in cuts over the next 2 years. There isn't enough money to cover basic educational needs.
A Vote No campaign surfaced at the last minute, and the mudslinging began. It's easy to get voters to think it's in their best interest to keep their money in their own pockets, especially in our current economy. It's easy to twist numbers that most voters don't even understand to begin with. And, of course, schools are the only place where voters get a direct vote on taxation. The current system of using local levies to raise funds for basic education needs has put the Lakeville School Board and administration in a reactive position. They should be in a positive position of visionary leadership, preparing our students for the future. The system has divided our community. The question is, are you for schools or are you for lower taxes? These questions shouldn't be in opposition of one another. Our schools should receive predictable funding from the state that covers the cost of education, educating our children, and provides equitable public education across the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's very much to the point, and I think I hope you're successful on your recount.
Yes.
Next is Robbinsdale. We have Brad Brown, Lynn Osterman, and Robin Smothers. And I see another person. Oh, superintendent.
Yep. Senator, the person that's not on your agenda is Dr. Stan Mack. He's the superintendent of our district.
Okay, welcome. please give your names for the record and then go ahead.
I'm Brad Brown. I'm a member of the Vote Yes Committee and also a school board member.
Go ahead and speak.
And our other two speakers, are at least joining us at the table, are Robin Smothers and Lynn Osterman, and they are also co-chairs, or I guess really tri-chairs, of our Vote Yes Committee. I can shorten my comments because a lot of what we were going to say has been said, and I hope those reoccurring themes are coming through. Robbinsdale is serves seven communities in the western suburbs. We have both inner ring suburbs and second ring suburbs. We have some wealth in our community. We have some poverty in our community. It's a demographically diverse kind of community. Before the election, we had done some polling, and we were polling about 60% approval for a referendum at the levels that we were seeking. We came in at about 47% in the actual election. What happened in between? Well, this year, for the first time, we actually had an organized opposition group, and the opposition group had hired a consultant from Iowa who, believe it or not, actually makes his living defeating referendums. I can't honestly say if that was a deciding factor. I think it was a contributing factor, but I think there are other more systemic things that we've been talking about here so far today that weighed as heavily. I think we're seeing sort of the front end, the leading edge of a taxpayer revolt on property taxes. That's what's underlying a lot of this. If you look at the demographics of our district, we have a lot of seniors and people who are on fixed incomes, and Senator Olson, I think you said it very well, these are not bad people who hate schools. There are people who are on fixed incomes who have seen their property values increase and are caught in between. So that's part of what has happened here. Well, what's the implications for the Robbinsdale School District? Again, it's a similar story has been told already. We'll definitely be closing one elementary school, possibly two. We'll be increasing our class sizes, and we'll be probably be eliminating some after-school programs for middle school students, exactly the wrong group of students that you want to have not having supervised activities after school. So what do we do from here? Obviously, there's the fiscal problems, the same problems that all the other districts have been talking about, having to reduce school buildings, having to increase class sizes, the things I just mentioned. But there's other things that are deeper. There have been wounds to our community. It's a very divisive process, and it's a very destructive process, because in order for the vote no to win, you have to impugn the integrity and the ability of the school system itself. You have to get people to believe that the schools are failing in order for people to say, I don't want to put any more money into a failing proposition. Now, that's very damaging, and it's a long-term fix that we have to go back now and re-win the trust of people who had, up to now, trusted us and respected the work that our staff and our teachers were doing. But that's what we're going to do, because that's what we have to do. What I want to emphasize in the time that we have is what, from our perspective at the front line in the trenches, do we need help with from the legislature? And that is all the things that have already been enumerated. Using property tax dollars to fund schools is a lousy way to fund schools for all the reasons that we've talked about. It alienates voters. It is a regressive tax for a segment of the voters, seniors. Senator Olson, you talked about it being stable. Well, it's not stable if you don't win your referendum. So property taxes are a bad way to fund schools. We need another way to do that. They're also expensive and divisive and distracting. We're in this business to educate children, not to run political campaigns. That's not what we're about. That's not what we're for. And we do it as well as we can, but that's not what we want to do. We want to get in the classroom and work with kids. And these things distract terribly from that fundamental core mission. What I'm calling for, and I think all of us agree here at this table, is we need fundamental reform of how we finance public education in this state. We don't need more tinkering. We don't need more adjustments. And I know, as I say that, how difficult that is for a legislative body, not just this legislative body, but all legislative bodies are built for incremental change. But this is a situation where, frankly, we do not have time for incremental change. Public education is about preserving our democracy. It's about preserving our standard of living. And the way we're funding it is we're killing it. We've talked already about how we're dismantling programs. We're taking away. We're retreating at precisely a time when public education is more important than it has ever been in our society's history. So if we have to, we'll go back and we'll do what we have to do to try to win the next referendum, if that's all we can do, because that's what we have to do. But that's not the long-term answer here. The long-term answer here is systemic, broad-based reform of the way we fund our public schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Superintendent Knight.
Chair Stumpf and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity. I think Brad Brown, as both a board member and one of our tri-chairs, said it the best. I can tell you that the divisiveness in the community that this situation creates is just astounding. Frankly, we have a wonderful school system, but the opponents decided that they needed to discredit the school system in order to pass. And provide the support for defeating the referendum. The bottom line is, and I agree with Senator Olson, is a legitimate position to oppose an increase in property taxes. We can deal with that issue. But to use that as a base to erode confidence in the local public school that is successful is inexcusable. And that, to me, is the travesty of the situation that we have created by this piece of legislation that allows these referendums to continue. That's the part that needs to come to an end. I've worked 36 years in this business, and I can tell you I have never been so low in my life. That's inexcusable. And the bottom line is that you, as legislators, need to take hold of the issue. We don't vote on whether we have police officers in the street. Somehow in Hennepin County, we could support having a referendum, or support not having a referendum to build baseball parks, but we can't support educating children. I don't understand.
Thank you, Superintendent.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, my question it was kind of sparked by Mr. Brown's earlier comments, but amplified by yours. The issues we've been talking about, the issues of property tax, but is what you would prefer board-approved levies rather than voter-approved levies? That would get around that would support the stability factor that was raised by Mr. Brown, or would you prefer that your funding was more heavily, if not 100%, from the state using other forms of taxation?
Chair Stumpf and Senator Olson, I would believe that I spoke to enough senior citizens, and I've had wonderful relationships with senior citizens in our community. I believe they are at the end of their tax-paying ability. I don't believe that the school board imposed property tax increases are appropriate for our citizens. I believe that that's unfair to our senior citizens who are on fixed incomes and who have had their properties exceed the value of their income. And as you stated so well earlier, the only way they have cash in hand is when they sell the property.
Well, Senator
Olson.
Dr. Mack, I'm glad you clarified that, because you were using the argument of not having to vote for our police, you know, our local. That's mm-hmm. The city council makes those decisions.
Right.
And I think rightly mm-hmm. protesting the fact that we didn't mm-hmm. get a right to vote
right.
on funding the, mm-hmm. the having our taxes mm-hmm. go for funding the stadium. Right. But so you really still do not feel that it just should be a board-approved right. Referendum then?
Chair Stumpf, Senator Olson, I believe that the issue of equity among and between children and having opportunities, our colleagues from North Central Minnesota stated it so well earlier. Their deficits are greater than our deficits with our neighbors. But the bottom line is that children who live across the street from one another should not have $600 to $700 less following them to school every day. And that becomes an issue of a state responsibility, according to the Constitution, a uniform system of public education.
Okay, very quickly, Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, just to acknowledge Representative Peterson and Representative Carlson and myself, we all represent the Robbinsdale School District, and we watched firsthand what you went through and are very sorry that that process did happen. And I know, as co-chair of the Hopkins Legislative Action Coalition some years back, that's why I'm sitting here, because I ran out of my disappointment with that whole process. So thank you.
Senator Bonhoeff, Chair Stumpf, thank you for those comments. And one of the things we talked about before we came on is the amount of effort that went into this. And again, no more so than any of the other groups,
right.
But it's a huge undertaking and diversion of energy from the community.
Mr. Chairman, I just one.
And I appreciate the sense of urgency that you're giving us, and also I think we have to keep coming back to that. There's an immense amount of complexity in it, because it's not just our school districts. It's our other taxing districts. It's the services that are being demanded, and how they're being paid for. And so I think we as a legislative body have to work through that in multiple committees, not just this one. So I appreciate all the urgency that you give us. So,
Mr. Chairman, just one quick comment.
Okay, we do have a Senator Olson.
I just wanted to offer
have about 10 more groups left. Senator Olson.
One of my districts was a victim of the same tactic couple years back, so I totally sympathize with you and what you've gone through.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Stumpf, Senator Olson, I learned through this referendum that somehow by the message of our friend from Iowa that I discovered that driving a Volkswagen is a luxury car and that phonics can cure needs for special ed. It's astounding.
Say that last part.
Phonics can cure the needs for special ed.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here. We have Kathy Mays and Peg Keenan from Minnetonka. And again, I'd ask if you could condense or bring out the important points. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Please give your name for the record.
Peg Keenan. I was chair of the Committee for Quality Academics, a citizens group in support of the Minnetonka School District No. 276 referendum.
And I'm Kathy Mays, and I was in charge of the communications for our group.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members. First, I'm thankful to report that Minnetonka did pass our operational levy. However, I do want to make it clear that it took an abundant amount of community member resources and time that could have been used instead to directly assist our students in learning and achievement. In the spring of 2007, after the legislature finalized the funding amounts for schools in the 07-08 and 08-09 school years, it became clear that Minnetonka School District would need to make $3.4 million in cuts for the 08-09 school year if they were going to balance their budget. This was following 12 of the last 15 years of budget cuts and programming cuts in Minnetonka. To avoid the $3.4 million in cuts, our school board voted unanimously in July to request voters to approve a $3.8 million annual levy for operational funds over 10 years. These are dollars that go directly into the classroom and curriculum. The Committee for Quality Academics began to rally community support to pass the referendum questions. In our district with approximately 28,000 registered voters, 65% do not have children attending Minnetonka Public Schools. We are able to get 200 volunteers to go out and help us secure the yes vote. Over 4,800 households were called by phone to identify supporters. Over 60 coffees and community events were held to explain to voters why the referendum needed to pass. Over 25,000 postcards were sent to residents to remind them of why it's important for the referendum to pass. And volunteers knocked on over 1,500 neighbors' doors to leave supporting literature. Nearly 3,200 households were called the week prior to Election Day to confirm they were going to vote yes. And those households, nearly 3,200, were called again November 6th, reminding them to go to the polls. While Minnetonka did pass their referendum question, I submit the time, the financial contributions to run the campaign, the effort expended by hundreds of people could have been used directly to impact our children instead of using these resources and energies to run a referendum campaign.
I heard someone say that you could run a referendum as a profession, and this is my third referendum that I was involved with, so I feel like perhaps I'm a professional now. I've seen the communications change over the years. Referendum used to be talking about the excess, the extras, the nice-to-haves. We're at the point where we have to communicate to people about millions that we're about to cut if the vote doesn't pass. Those are the need-to-haves, not the nice-to-haves. We've communicated to our community that the meager 1% increase from the state is not adequate, and our community understands that referendum is simply a 3 to 4 year Band-Aid to stop the bleeding. It occurred to me as I was sitting in the back, with all the stories that you've heard this morning, and you've understood what we've gone through, I wonder if the tables were to turn and if state legislators could run a successful campaign on the promise of raising taxes. Because every time our schools go for referenda, we ask them the same.
We come to you today to tell you that referendum should not be for the essentials. And we really do look forward to coming and working with you on sustainable, stable E-12 funding, not just for Minnetonka, but for all children in the state.
Thank you very much. I think that's a goal that all of us should have, so thank you. Next, I'd like to ask Tammy Epley from Osseo. Welcome, and if you could give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tammy Epley. I'm a parent in the Osseo School District. I have three children there, and I have been a full-time volunteer in our school district for about 8 years. I have done all sorts of coordination of character ed programs, diversity programs, student leadership programs, working with our magnet schools. But for the last 3 months, I've been a full-time volunteer for our levy campaign. I should tell you about our district. Our district is the fifth largest in the state. We have over 22,000 students, and we had three levy questions on the ballot. The first would be to renew two levies and to add $8.3 million to cover past state aid shortfalls. Number two was $8.6 million for shortfalls from state aid for 2007, 8, and 9. And number three was $5 million to advance our students' technology skills. Our Vote Yes committee worked very hard. I could tell you all of the things that we did, but they're very similar to what the other school districts did. We had a large group of volunteers. We used every means of communication that we could, did lots of presentations and phone calling and flyers, and raised over $22,000 to pay for all of the things that we were trying to use to get the word out to people. Attended all the parent-teacher conferences, lots of community organization, church meetings, that kind of thing. But we didn't pass them all. Our first levy question passed. The other two failed. Some of the challenges that are similar to what the other school districts have shared with you. 75% of our residents do not have children in our schools, so that was a tough bump to get over right there. Also, we found that residents don't understand the funding. Even though our school district has a community organization that looks over the finances of the district and opens those books to everyone, there are so many people who don't understand. And one challenge that I haven't heard the other school districts mention yet is that we were told over and over again that the state, the legislators, are the ones who do understand school funding. And if they don't feel that our schools need more money, then why are you asking us? And that was a really hard one to overcome. And I guess that puts the ball back in your court. It was hard for me to explain why the levy authority has increased over 75% in the last 5 years and state funding has increased 1.5% over those same years. The equalization is also very tough to explain. Our district, for example, gets 1.62% in state aid for this year's levy money, which, of course, is different from district to district. So our taxpayers are responsible for over 98% of the levy money. As the Grand Rapids superintendent mentioned earlier, I agree all of our state's kids deserve the same quality education, and our strategy right now just isn't providing that. It's even harder for me to explain it to our students. At one of the first presentations that I did at one of our junior highs, there was a student there with her parents. At the end of the presentation, the PowerPoint slide that was still up behind me had the list of reductions that we would have to implement if our levies failed. And she came up to me afterwards, and she pointed to the slide, and she said, "Please don't let that happen to us." And it was a tough thing. It really motivated me to get out and do as many presentations as I could, go to all the phone banks, do everything that I possibly could. The sad thing was, it wasn't enough. Now we'll cut $16 million out of our budget. Without counting special ed, we have a $120 million budget. So 16 out of that is quite a chunk. We'll have to decide which one or two schools that we're going to close. We'll have to lay off approximately 120 of our teachers. We'll add 4 to 6 students per classroom, and some are already in the high 30s, so that'll bump us over 40 in some classes. We'll increase the activity fees for the sports and extracurriculars that we're able to keep. Some will probably be eliminated because it'll just get too high for our kids to be able to afford.
And we're looking at increasing the walking distance to 2 miles. And when you think about a first grader walking 2 miles to school, it just is really difficult. So I guess I'd like to close by repeating that student's plea to you. Don't let this continue to happen to our students. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Epley. Next we have Stillwater District, John, is it Seibert, and Kathy Buchholz.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning. My name is John Seibert, and I'm the co-chair of our Yes to Kids in Stillwater campaign. Before I'd start, I'd like to, well, there's only two of us sitting up here, I'd like all the Stillwater people to stand, please.
Goodness,
these people are a large number of the people that helped work on our campaign, and they each represent strong personal constituencies. So what we would like to say is that we're here to support an effort to change school funding, and we're also here in support of all these other districts as well. We're here for the long haul. I'm a technology business owner. I'm an electrical engineer. I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota. I'm a product of public education, and I'm a PTA president. But most importantly, I am the parent of two children, 13 and 15 years old, who are currently in the public schools, and I support schools as the single most important institution in the state. So I'm here to give you kind of a boots-on-the-ground context of what our system of levy means for our schools. I'm going to tell you what it is, what it's like to try and pass a levy in a district like ours, and I'm going to tell you about the divided communities with underfunded schools that are often left behind. I'm going to tell you about the impossibility of having a serious and reasonable and desperately needed policy discussion within the constraints of the system that we have. I think Stillwater is a very special case, and it's worthy of your notice. We have a small rural, small town kind of community identity, but yet we're suburban. We're not wealthy in terms of property value, and just about 30% of our households had children of school age, which I think you've heard from a number of other districts. Stillwater schools have a legacy of top-notch academics, athletics, art, music programs, and we've won lots and lots of awards for our fiscal management as a school district. So in other words, we're a high-performing district, and we are in many ways a microcosm of the state as a whole. On top of that, as a school district, I think we're at risk. This year we tried to get three levy questions passed. The first question was a renewal of our longstanding levy that expires shortly. Questions 2 and 3 were intended to reduce class size by an average of 2.3 students across the district and update the curriculum. Question 1 passed, and questions 2 and 3 failed. These are modest requests and in total represent a cost to an average homeowner in our district of about $12 a month. The class size reductions promised by the passage of these levies would have only taken us halfway back to the class sizes that we had in 2002, which is when our current and now expiring levy was passed. So it's pretty clear we're not making any gains here. Currently in our district, class sizes are large because of inflationary attrition over time and the failure of state funding to keep pace. For example, in my son's 10th grade classes, every class is either 36 or 37 kids in classrooms that are designed for 25. Had question 1 failed, those numbers would have approached 50. I don't think the desks would fit, literally. Our kids do well on any test you put in front of them, and they easily exceed national and state averages. Our district has won awards for its financial management and reporting. It has an excellent bond rating that's achieved by a few other districts. Yet the kids graduating for the last several years have known nothing except cuts and a gradual but continuous decline in services, in class offerings, and in educational opportunities. If you live in the metro area and you watch the news, you probably heard a lot about the contentious Stillwater schools public levy. We had an active vote no group who used the time-tested tactics of the Taxpayers League, including anonymity, misrepresentations, and massive lit drops in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. The goal was to create doubt about our schools, because if even a shred of mistrust is planted in the mind of the public, levies will fail. We made a decision early on to challenge the claims of the vote no group without exception and to never give them an inch. No distortion, no misrepresentation would go unanswered, and so as a result of that, the campaign became contentious. Our local Vote No group slogan was demand accountability, which for anyone knowledgeable about our district's operations is really quite ridiculous. Just look at the results this district turns out, both in academics and financially, and I think you'd agree. But a slogan like this does just enough to create suspicion that money isn't being spent wisely and to cause many people to vote no who would otherwise vote for the levies. Our campaign was guided by two co-chairs and a steering committee of 15 people, many of whom you have seen behind me, all whom worked full-time on this campaign for several months at a time, in addition to holding down regular day jobs. These people are highly skilled professionals in sales, marketing, communications, executive staff, quality level people, variety of other disciplines, and they were putting in long, long hours. We raised and spent about $55,000, which was the largest ever in our district by a long ways. We had many hundreds of people come forward to volunteer to work on special events and projects within the community. We installed four times as many signs as had ever been done in any past campaign. We ran ads in every paper in our district many times. We mailed literature to thousands and thousands of homes. We wrote numerous editorials every week for months. We sold T-shirts, marched in parades in quantities of 350 at a time. We called thousands on the phone, door knocked to hundreds more, ran pancake breakfasts for hundreds of people. And after all this, we only passed one question, the question that allows us to continue to tread water. So I don't think the message could be more clear, and we've heard it repetitively since the election as voters come to us to vocalize why they voted this way. The message is, do no additional harm to our schools and get this mess fixed at the state level. I think it's very clear. Our community remains bitterly divided. Our schools are not trusted the way they should be because of continuous distortion from anti-tax vote no efforts. Just as we were sitting here waiting for this hearing to start, we were talking about the two editorials that we need to write to counter two more editorials that are in the paper criticizing our schools and attacking them. Our Vote Yes people are weary, and they're concerned because we know that all our work really only put a Band-Aid on this problem. Our Vote No people are angry because things passed. In other words, no one is happy, and we're certain our next levy campaign will be worse and much more contentious than this one. So what have we learned from all of this? First, school finance is insanely and needlessly complex. It is impossible to explain to voters in the course of a levy campaign. When a vote no group twists statistics to make a district look bad, it's almost impossible in this soundbite world to fight back with the truth because the truth is just too complex. By asking districts to put levy questions to a vote, we are essentially asking voters to make operational decisions on highly complex and technical issues about how to run the schools. Is this really how we want our best practices determined? And why do we have administrators and school boards? Second, levy campaigns often leave behind bitterly divided communities. All that a vote no group needs to do to sow the seeds of doubt is all they need to do is sow the seeds of doubt for their campaign to be successful. They create a cloud of suspicion around the schools while hiding behind their anonymity. This angers school supporters and they fight back. Both sides end up angry at the end of these campaigns. Relationships over time between neighbors are fractured. Public schools that used to bring communities together as a source of community pride now are often pulling them apart. In these kind of campaigns, there are no winners. Third, school levies are the only chance that voters have to directly vote against their taxes. Counties and city taxes go up, and citizens have no way to respond other than voting out the people who made the decisions. This is the way it should be. As legislators, would you be able to fund anything here in the legislature if you had to submit each and every funding bill to a referendum? I think not. So the question really becomes, and I don't know if it's a valid one or not, but why do school boards not have the same authority as counties and cities? Fourth, levy campaigns are an enormous productivity sinkhole for communities. A levy campaign takes people away from their jobs and families, and instead of working and earning more to pay more income tax and create more jobs, these volunteers are working on levy campaigns. Because I'm a business owner, you know, things like payroll are top of my mind, and I'd estimate that if I took the incremental dollars our district will be getting from next year's levy, which is about $1 million, just slightly less, it's probably about equal to the volunteer time if we charge it out at an appropriate billable rate. I'm not sure that makes any sense at all, and I'm not sure what kind of a parallel universe that does make sense in. Fifth, it is relatively easy and inexpensive to sink school levies. The playing field is not level. All voters need is one excuse, one nagging doubt, and they have their justification to vote down school levies. Vote no groups are becoming very skilled in giving them that perfect soundbite reason, and I think the vote no kind of campaign consultants is probably a big growth industry right now. In Stillwater, we were lucky that enough people were willing to sacrifice a normal life to work on this campaign full-time, and it's shocking that we had to work so hard just to keep what we had. So what does this all come down to, and what do we really need from the legislature, and what would we like to work with the legislature on? Number one is we want you to engage experts to determine what constitutes an adequate education that is relevant to our times, to determine what it costs, and to properly fund it in a simpler and more sustainable fashion. It must be an excellent education if the state is going to compete internationally and if we want to preserve our quality of life. Two, we want you to get the politics out of education. Education is too important, and these politics are simply too toxic. It's a shameful thing for us to be moving our schools as a whole in the state towards mediocrity simply because of politics. Three, we need to get this done quickly. The next round of levies is going to be even worse. We as a state and you as a legislature must do all that you can to let that not happen, because in the process we're wasting enormous human capital. Finally, in closing, I'd like you to consider what happens if we don't fix this system. The political confrontations are going to escalate because schools are starved for cash and parent groups will advocate ever more aggressively for levy passage. Consequently, vote no groups will become even more vociferous in their opposition. Neither of us has any choice, because this is the only system that we have and the rules are clear. We're constrained to this fight the way it is. The divisions in the community are going to get deeper. They're going to last longer. The acrimony is going to get worse. And the schools and the kids will suffer directly. The cost to repair our schools after a levy is failed, if it can even be repaired, has got to be much, much larger than the cost to keep them whole. So that was my presentation. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to try and answer them at this point.
Okay, I think we'll let everyone think. And is it Kathy Buchholz?
Thank you. My name is Kathy Buchholz. I am the chair of the Stillwater School Board. My message is quite simple. It's just a reminder that the times are changing. We are now living in the 21st century. The bottom line is there are fewer and fewer people involved and connected with public schools. Many people have mentioned the aging of our society, and I just want to give you our statistics on that. I think you've heard this before. In 3 short years, the baby boom of Minnesota will start turning 65. 10 years after that, we will have more people over 65 than in school. This has never happened before in Stillwater, in Minnesota, or in the nation. I think this has very large ramifications on public schools. The other thing that's happening since referendum started in the late 80s was now we have more choices for education. The number of people who are homeschooling has increased. The number of students in charter schools has increased. And in our school district, our charter school is also planning to double their enrollment while maxing out their class size at 25. That's very attractive, and that's a very difficult one to retain kids in our system. So in Stillwater, like many of the other communities today, 70% of our voters do not have school-aged children. Of the school-aged children, 22% of them, or for us about 2,000 kids, are choosing to go elsewhere. That does not leave a very large group of people involved or connected in the public schools. While we won by over 1,000 votes, we really did lose. I can't tell you how divided, scarred, and angry our community is. We are pitting old against young, and I'd just like to read this letter real briefly. It's from a Mr. Jack Bishop, who I never met in the campaign, but he lives in my small town of Afton. Dear Mrs. Buchholz, I live in Afton, and I wonder where you and the other school board officers think retired people on a set income can afford more property tax increases. Sure, people on Social Security have received increases, but their medical premiums have eaten up the difference. This is not right when the school board wants more from this group. Apparently, you folks want the retired people taxed out of their homes and out on the street. This is not what a school board person should be doing, dividing people. Now, I'm very grateful that question one did pass, but I am here to speak about and also acknowledge the school districts who did not pass. And the question has been raised, as a school board person, do I want to make a levy decision on our own? And frankly, no. It would be very difficult because now the standard has been set by Minnetonka, and I'm very happy for them. But they're at $1,800 per child. In addition, they are going to receive $5 million for technology over the next 10 years. That's $50 million. Now, if that's the bar now, how are school districts going to compete and offer an equal education? We've got two boys here, 10th graders at Stillwater High School, who took the day. They are very involved and very concerned. And it pains me to look at these boys and to say, you will not get the same education that you could in Minnetonka. I think the other thing I want to share with you is I did try to spend a lot of time with our Vote No people. I really tried to understand what their thoughts were and their changes. The bottom line is they believe you pay to play, and only the people in public schools should pay for the services. Now, that is an idea, but I think we have to be very honest. If we move down that road, we no longer have a public school system. We have a private system. And if that's the way the state wants to move, we need to think forward and to really understand, in thinking about the achievement gaps that we have and we know about between the American Indian, the Black, the Hispanic populations compared to the Asian and white, how will we deal with that if we're moving towards a pay-to-play situation? So I'm just here to remind everybody, we're in the 21st century, it's now. Our health care is allowing for an aging community, but that is affecting public education. People are no longer affected. And when we ask people, what can we do about that, they say, okay, school board, you need to spend more time with the elderly community. Superintendent, you need to spend more time. They need to get to know you. That's a public relations job. We are here to lead the schools. So I'm just asking, I want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. But we have to acknowledge that the 21st century is here. We have challenges, and we need to start making some public policy changes because our world is changing. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me just lay out. We're kind of over our time, and we still have five more school districts. And I know there's probably going to be questions that committee members would like to ask. So just so everyone keeps that in mind, and I know the importance of this issue is one that's going to be, receive a lot of discussion in the next few months and as we look forward. But so, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted a clarification. When you said 22, I believe you said 22%
are school-aged children are making choices other than our public schools.
Are you including charter schools in that?
Yes, I
because
am.
That is a public school. Okay,
correct.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Senator Salt.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair. These parents are who have inspired me, that really make the case that we have put parents in the trenches of public education. And the discussions that I believe we need to be brave and bold to have, to put our parents, when you have a child in Minnesota, to say, and please expect to go out and beg your public for money so your child is educated, must stop. I just encourage all of you, though, to stay involved, because I think the people at this table today, I hope, are moved by this discussion that we are asking far too much of parents when we want you in classrooms, when we want you with your families. But I am truly moved by what I saw in my community and the extraordinary efforts and the disappointment, fatigue, exhaustion, that happened the day afterwards when people said, I don't know if I could do this again. And the way our funding system is now, in 6 years, you're going to have to do it again in order to maintain the quality of our schools. Thank you.
Okay. I think what we'll do is we'll ask South Washington County, Leslie Boyd, Michelle Witt, and then right after that we'll have Sauk Rapids and Rice. So actually they could come up and be there too, Joan Houck and Mark Hoog. If you just shift over one chair there, that way, just to have respect that that there are, I believe there's someone else that's going to be coming into this hearing room. So, okay, welcome and give your name and please go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Leslie Boyd. With me is Michelle Witte. We were the leaders of the VOTE committee, which was a citizens committee in South Washington County. VOTE stands for Value and Opportunity Through Education. We've actually been the leaders for two campaigns in the last year and a half. So we're grateful that we were one of the success stories of this last campaign season. However, it was a request for a renewal of two expiring referendums, no new taxes, and a result, no new property taxes, or no increase to property taxes. We had been told through research that we did earlier in the year that over 70% of our constituents supported or strongly supported a referendum that did not increase property taxes but kept our schools at the same level as they are now. In the end, we received 54% of the support with just 18% voter turnout. For us, it was success, but not the kind of success that we had expected. This is further evidence that the tax climate says enough is enough on individual taxpayers, and particularly a climate that says we have the right to say no to public education when we can't say no elsewhere.
I think that's obviously the big message about equity and fairness, and I think that's what we really want to underscore again, and we haven't talked about, is equity and fairness and cost assessment about education, because I can think of no other place in education where, as the costs go up, anybody else, if the costs go up, the city will raise your taxes, or the state will raise your taxes, or the gas pump will charge more money, or whatever it is. But in the schools, the costs go up, and we have taken lean, I would say, down to anorexic. I think I brought 4 rolls of paper towels, 6 boxes of Kleenex, and hand soap to school. So we've gotten to the point where our fluff is gone, but people don't understand that. So I think we have to work together to better understand the costs and show the fairness and equity. As our costs have gone up, and in factoring in things like health insurance, I mean, a 15% increase in health insurance, that means these costs have gone up. They're going to come somewhere other than, you know, selling more wrapping paper and cookie dough, which is what we do a lot of. So I think fairness and equity and cost, and then being able to pay for that cost. And what we saw in our referendum was that people felt like we were constantly coming to them for money, and we are, because of the way the property tax is structured. Again, we have 3 levies outstanding. We bundled 2 in our district. But we're going to have to come back again because we can only authorize those for 10 years. So people feel like, well, you just came to us. Well, we did, but we have to come again because that's the way the system is set up. So to find, again, a way to put cost and equity, or equity and fairness into what it actually costs to educate, and then to have that provided in a way we don't have to keep going back and forth. We are very much supporters of equity, the Schools for Equity and Education, and their message of equity across the state. And one place I think we all certainly, hopefully, we could find a way is with the ballot language, which was very skewed and I would say not equitable. In our ballot language, we had to say at the end, it said, by voting yes on this ballot question, you are voting to renew a property, or the R said, by voting yes on this ballot question, you are voting for a property tax increase, which really wasn't true. We were asking them to renew a current tax levy. And that was very confusing. We had lots of people say, wait a minute, you said we weren't going to raise our taxes. This was a renewal. So I think, on the other hand, we should be able to say what a vote no means. If we say this is what yes means, we should also be able to say, if you vote no, that means $14 million will no longer be available in your school district or whatever it is. Again, I think fairness and equity works both ways. We should be able to be clear and find better messages to communicate these issues to the public. We thank you for your time.
Thank you. Those are good points. Is it Joan?
Yeah, it's Joni Houck, and Mark Houck is my husband. He's not here because he's somewhere else. Thank you very much. I have three children in the Sauk Rapids Rice School District, ages 9, 12, and 15, and in our school district that means three different schools. Our referendum asked for $700 per student. In our referendum, too, we are the only school in 30 miles now without a levy in place. We had over 10,000 hours of volunteer time. There was many, many hours. My children went for quite a long time without their parents' input. We live in a great community, which ended up pitting one neighbor against the other. It was very difficult. We are second from the bottom on the per pupil funding, and that's funding from the state. So now we're second from the bottom of per pupil funding without an operating levy as well. We get approximately, I believe it's 700 and some per pupil now, or 5,000 and some. We do not have an operating levy because it failed. It failed 2,000 to 3,000. In the community, we felt it was going well, except for we were the district that St. Cloud talked about that had something against our superintendent, which, if you know Greg Vandell, that is rather a strange thing, since you can't ask for a nicer person. Their argument was he made way too much money, which, if you know any superintendent, you would feel they can't make enough money. I am here to say to you, raise my taxes. And I ask, when did the excess levy become just an operating levy? That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. So both of your referendums were defeated, right?
We only had one question.
Oh, one question, okay.
Sauk Rapids, not Sauk Rapids.
All right. Thank you. Okay, next, are there any questions? Next we have Elk River, and we'll invite Princeton up as well. Lisa?
Mr. Chair, I don't see the Princeton folks.
Okay. So Dr. Mark Bezek.
Thank you, Senator Stump. I brought several people along here with me today, a couple school board members, a couple parents, some district people, teachers, to talk about a little bit about our story, which is significantly different from what you've heard in the previous testimonies. A little bit about Elk River. Elk River is a very large district. It's your ninth largest district in the state. It's located in the northwest suburbs, but we are non-metro, which hurts us. We take in four major cities and 16 other communities. We have a student population around 12,300 students. We are growing 400 to 500 students a year. 3 years ago, we put 700 kids in new seats. We are growing broke. A little bit of the overview. We run about $100 million budget. We offer a very basic education to our kids. We don't have the fluff or the extra classes. We run a 6-period day. We have very limited advanced classes. We offer no languages in the elementary, middle school, what have you. Very basic. We have three levies in place right now that total $694. Our funding stream is about $1,000 per student less than the state average. In our district, that's $12 million a year that we do not have to offer programs that other metro districts have. When our district is built out, we will have approximately 30 to 35 thousand students in the next 20 to 25 years. if you've been up in our area, you know, we take in Zimmerman, we take in Elk River, we take in Otsego, we take in Rogers. Now, if you've ever tried to drive up north or out west on Friday afternoon, you know what that's like. When that 101 corridor is done to Elk River, the booming is going to happen. When the commuter line is finished that's coming right through Elk River, we're going to be in trouble. We have roughly about 400 seats left in the district. We took a very aggressive approach on levy and bond this year to satisfy the needs of the district for the next 5 years. This district has been, with the great growth rate, has been going to the voters every year. And we heard one thing loud and clear, don't come back every year. So we put a very comprehensive and aggressive plan to solve our problems for 5 years. Actually, when these schools were built and completed in 3 to 4 years, they would be full again. We're running out of space. We've got portables at four sites. Our class sizes are they're unacceptable. When you start running kindergarten classes of 24, 25, middle school classes of 36, 37, and high school classes of 38 to 42, and again, we don't offer any frills. We have 17 schools right now. Forbes has listed us as the 100th fastest growing community in the country, which tells you what kind of an anomaly we are. Again, we're growing broke. We've got a very different demographic than the people that have testified previously. We have very young families. We have pages and pages and pages of foreclosures in our district, but the kids keep coming. This year alone, we took in over 400 more students. We thought it would slow down. We backed our budgets off and our projections, but we have no room. So what does that mean? It's going to mean larger class sizes for us. It's going to mean fewer programs for kids, which we don't have right now. Those programs, the frills were cut, I would say, about 8 to 9 years ago as the district was growing and couldn't afford them. Some of the parents that are with me here can talk a little bit about the what we went through with the levy election. We had to run a levy and a bond. We probably had the largest bond on the ticket. We had a $133 million bond this year. We had a high school in Zimmerman. We had a K-8 building in Otsego. We had an addition onto Rogers High School. And we had other additions to house the students that are coming in. We had to run a levy also, a $5.1 million levy, to operate those schools because we were not in the financial position to run a bond and then open up schools. We had to have the operating capital at the same time. The average tax impact to the average home in the area was, $450 per home per year, roughly around $45 per month. Through our canvassing, surveying, what have you, that was the tax tolerance at the time back in May that said, you know what, we'll support this, we'll vote for it. Our canvassing came through that we have the votes necessary to pass this. But what happened on Election Day? You look at the state of the economy, the consumer confidence. We figured if we had 10,000 votes or less, we would pass this. Well, about 12,500 showed up, and they hammered us. Even the 7,000 yes votes we had in our pocket changed their mind. We only had 5,000 yes votes. Roughly on both questions, we got beat about 60-40, somewhere in that area. A little bit about the cost of the elections. No one's really talked about that. Our committee raised about $35,000 for just vote yes type information. But what do districts spend besides the human capital or the employee time? Communications cost us over $100,000 to sell our message to our voters. We don't have a communications director. We had to use that money for this campaign. Just the legal costs involved with balloting, the language and what have you, cost us over $50,000 to run an election, the legal pieces. Besides survey consultants and what have you, and the time that the district people spent, if you factor all that in, I'm sure we spent over $225,000 running this election from different sources of monies that, you know, again, could we make better use of that money? Sure we could. But the situation with the way we have to run elections forces us into informing people the way we have to. A few things, how you can help us, a few ideas here. We've been down talking before to the legislature about increased funding for special situations. You know, our population, we receive about $7,500 per student in our funding stream. State average is $8,600. Again, that's about $12 million a year less for us. All the districts that have lobbied and are in that $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $11,000 have special populations that trigger funding. We have a special population, too, and it's called kids, and they're coming out of our ears. And I know that's something other districts would love to have. You know, sometimes it's a blessing, sometimes it's a curse, and now it's hurting us. We need some increased funding for the special growth that we have. The lease levy option that we have, you know, where you provide $100 per student, we need to up that so we can at least provide temporary structures or the 20% rule of adding on to buildings that we have existing so we can, again, at least invest our money wisely. We heard before from one of the districts here that election and ballot referendum reform needs to happen. If we're the only public entity that needs to go out for elections and raise money, the deck can't be stacked against us. There needs to be some reform in what we can say, how we can do it, and when we can run these elections if we have to continue this. And also in a district our size and where we're going, we are definitely larger than a lot of the cities of the first class. If there can be some consideration to give us some of those opportunities to use levy and building authority or bonding authority, that would help us also. The kids are coming, and we have no place to put them right now. Joe Stangler here is our director of testing and assessment and research. He ran with the communities the campaign, and I guess I would ask him just to talk a little bit about the effort that went into that campaign.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Our district...
If you can give your name for the record, please.
I'm Joe Stangler, and I'm Director of Research and Assessment for the Elk River School District. Our district has been growing for quite some time, and we've been struggling with budgets for quite some time. We don't have frills. Our students, as Dr. Bezek mentioned earlier, receive a six-period day. We are not staffed thick administratively. Our class sizes are large. We don't have a communication specialist working full-time in the district, not even part-time. So many of the responsibilities of the campaign fell to myself and Charlie Blessner, the community education director. During the campaign time, I was spending about 18 to 20 hours a day, some of it on the clock, most of it off the clock, attempting to make sure that the message we were trying to communicate was clearly communicated to the community. I had board members giving me a little bit of grief for sending emails at 3 o'clock in the morning, but in many respects, we were on a campaign trail, much like many of you are on when you're out during election season putting in 18-hour days. That's what it was like for us, except when I was in the office, I was also expected to complete the other aspects of my job. So to put the burden or to put the stress on the public schools to run a campaign, our job is to educate, and we did our best job of educating the public, and quite honestly, we did our work. We felt very good heading into Election Day, and when the results came back, I know I wasn't the only one who felt like they'd just gotten slapped. It was a very difficult night when we saw the results coming back because we felt we had the support of the community. We didn't have major opposition. We had a handful of letters to the editor against us, and that was it. So for us, it was a very disappointing ending to what we thought was a very successful campaign.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley.
This is Tina Graff, who is one of our parents who headed up the center of the district campaign. Tina, I don't know if you have a couple of comments.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Tina Graff, and I don't have anything written here, but I just wanted to say, just to tell you a little bit about myself, 13 years ago, I was a professional. As many of the other people in this room, I made the decision to stay home, to take care of my family, to be there for my kids, to help them with their homework, to get them at school, to help them at school, to get them to their football, baseball, dance, whatever it is. And I think I've successfully have done that, and just currently have run into roadblocks as my kids are getting older. And you know, looking at their future and what the things they want to be, the things they want to do. And as we've said, our district is so huge, and we just do not have the funding to provide for our kids the way we should. And I'm looking at, you know, what can I do for them? So when I was asked to join this campaign, I jumped on the bandwagon. I said, I'm going. We have to do this. We have to do this for our kids. We have to do it to take a stand, to not just change it for Elk River. We have to change it for the state. And so I worked with a lot of people. We worked long hours. We worked, it wasn't just a Monday or a Friday. It was every day. I'm a very big supporter of kids. I'm a very big supporter of my family. I four nights a week, I sit at football fields in August, September, October. I usually am on the sidelines, running alongside them, cheering for them. Instead, I was running alongside parents, asking them, are you aware of this referendum? Do you know how it will help our kids? We need your yes vote. Basketball games, just repeatedly anywhere I was, PTO meetings. I was talking to parents, trying to, you know, make sure they understood the need. And we thought we had that stressed. And then it came down to, you know, to the last minute, and we didn't. I mean, I was actually even told by my husband that all this time that I was spending on this campaign, I was neglecting my kids because I wasn't running along the side. That pained me so much. I mean, then the night of election, when I found out that we have our community that's not supporting, I mean, that pained me even more. It's we have to as a community stand up for our kids. You, more importantly, have to take a stand and stand up for our kids. You asked, well, one thing, the value of a child. Now, the way it's worked, the value of one child is obviously greater than the value of another child. That's not the way I was raised. That's not the way I'm sure any of us were brought up to believe, but that's the way it is, the way the funding is done today. You asked about the same offerings. Do we have the same offerings? No. We haven't had the same offerings forever. Our middle school is without foreign language. We have no extracurricular activities for our middle school kids. In the high school, we have limited electives. We have limited AP classes. We have no performing arts in two-thirds of our districts. How are we even allowed to compete with anyone else in our state? We can't, because we're not provided with that funding. And then another thing, our community, it's not up to our communities to come up and say, yes, I want to vote this in, or no, I don't want to vote this in. And, you know, why they do that or not, I don't know. I know a lot of people say it's because it's the one thing we can say no to. We can't say no to, you know, other taxes. We can say no to this. So we're going to take a stand and we're going to do it. That is not what our Constitution says. Our Constitution says that every individual is entitled to an education, and you are not providing it for us. So I ask you today to please relook at the way this is all structured, the way the funding is done, and make a difference. Make a difference. Stand up for our kids. The time is now to provide that education. It's not tomorrow. It's not in another couple of years. It's now. Our kids are in a different... then even when you grew up, when I grew up, they're in a different state of education, if you'd say. They're not just competing with their next-door neighbor or someone in another state. They're competing with the world. It's a global market. We need to be able to provide that education to them to make them marketable, to provide them with what they need, give them a well-rounded education. And we need to do that now. We need to do it today. So I ask, when you leave here today, that you really look at what everybody has said and just, you know, what can I do? What can I do to make a difference? What can I do to change this for our children? And they're only given one chance. And we need to give that to them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for the testimony. Thank you for being so patient.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
may I? Just a short sure. comment. I represent the north end of the Elk River School District, and that $12 million that Elk River doesn't get because our formula is so horrible, if you just imagine what they could do if they got the average of the state of Minnesota. And Elk River is a school district that I worked very hard to get just $500,000 for last year in our last session and was unsuccessful in getting them just $500,000. It would have helped a lot. I also represent Princeton, who's not here, but I met with members of the board yesterday. Princeton at this point in time, also because of the way the formula is written, is even lower on the totem pole than Elk River is. And Princeton right now has the maximum number possible of portables, and they need more next year. They had three questions on the ballot, and all three failed by a 2-to-1 margin.
Those are two very fast-growing communities out there. We have one.
Senator, one comment.
Yes, Mr.
That
Dr.
when we made the comment about the staff working, you know, these are all hours that they put in over and above their duty time, the district people, you know, because that just shows the dedication that these people have. When Joe puts in these hours, he has other duties to do. I have other duties to do, but I personally probably gave about 60 to 70 presentations to explain. And not to sell, but to explain this referendum. So it was very time-consuming.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. The last one is Pine Island. Chris Bates, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Sure.
I was just trying to reflect. Your circumstances are so different in your growth. I didn't get the number of students that you have, but the talking about the parents and all the work that was done with parents, generally we think of the parents as being the biggest support block. If all of your parents had voted for it, it should have passed, should it not?
Well, here's an interesting statistic.
Except
here.
That you've got a lot of, you know, a lot of times they're not financially in the best circumstances to carry that whole load either.
Theoretically, we should have 24,000 parents. And when you only get 5,000 yes votes, that tells you something. And we, through our canvassing, had 7,000 committed yes votes. But something happened between, you know, the weeks before and we had no organized opposition. There was maybe three or four letters negative, and it was so silent, and that was a warning too. But people were just not engaged.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bates here? Chris Bates from Pine Island. If not, then we have gone through the agenda. Oh, Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we've done the agenda, and maybe we're going to conclude here pretty quickly, but I do want to ask that the committee, as we think on what we've heard and we look at what we want to do to try to address some of the issues that we faced, there is data that comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, and I believe this is the most recent. It's a couple of years ago, but I think that what we're hearing is, and we've asked some questions of our testifiers, and what we seem to be getting a consistent call for is that the funding ought to be provided by the state, 100%. In some cases, we've heard people say, we've asked questions about whether voter-approved levies should be eliminated in favor of board-approved levies. Those things have not been warmly embraced by our witnesses, But I think that we should look at what other states are doing. And right now, Minnesota, according to this data, is third highest in terms of percentage of funding from state sources. Arkansas has 72%. This is Minnesota 71%. Hawaii has 86%. So the average across the United States is less than 50% of funding comes from state sources. Our neighboring states, Wisconsin has 52%, Iowa 46%. South Dakota has 34%, North Dakota has 38%. So other states that are similar to Minnesota, other states in our region, are not funding at 100% of their funding coming from the state resources. Reason I'm raising this is I don't believe it is a panacea. I think the problems that we're hearing are real. I think it suggests that there are questions about how we are structuring education. Maybe the cost structure is not sustainable. We have heard, and I believe that it's correct, that as we age, we are going to have more people of retirement age than on fixed incomes, presumably, than people in schools. Can we continue to operate the kind of system that we have today, given that changing demographic? I think that the failures in the referendum are troubling. We've heard a lot of testimony talking about the disconnect between people in the community and their schools, which is troubling. We've heard about people saying that it's the only tax they can vote against directly, so they vote against, which would, to me, suggest that there's a problem with taxation generally, regardless of where it comes from. All taxes are paid out of income. I think that it might be good for us to say, well, what have other states done? How have they structured their funding of education? If they're not going 100% to state funding, which no state has, and we're one of the highest in that direction, if that's not the answer, what is the answer in terms of the structural problem? Because I believe we have a structural problem, and we're hearing testimony to it. I'm just not persuaded that the recommendation that we're getting is, in fact, perhaps going to solve the problem. And so could I ask that this committee, perhaps maybe our research folks, can look at what other states are doing and whether they may offer some help for us as we look at what is the model. And you've talked about this is more than just an education committee problem. I think you're right. But I'm hesitant to embrace the idea that if we just take all the funding over at the state level, we're going to solve this problem. I see danger in that then, in my mind, there is no reason to have local school boards at all. We fight the battle at the federal level saying we don't want the federal government to come in and give money to the state and then tell us what to do. But do we want the state to take over all the funding, all the policy making, and then tell local districts, here's how you have to do what you have to do? Do we want to neglect that whole element of local decision making and connection in the community with education? So to me, these are problems that are not just financial, but the structure of the financing is important to the solution to all these problems. So I guess I want to point this out so that I hope that we can get some information from other places that might be useful as we consider what we should do in Minnesota as we go forward. So thank you.
I think the education bill that we tried to put together last year in the Senate had, there were like four aspects that we worked very hard on. One was to try to build that base, increase the size of the pie, so to speak. And the other one was to look at those expenditures where some of the testimony was directed toward the cross subsidy. In other words, where their costs for their general education was being siphoned off to pay for special education and kind of areas that were mandated on both at a federal and state level. And then we tried to look at how we could stabilize funding, and I think that's one disagreement. I think property taxes do have a very important part in the overall funding of our education system. I don't think, we should think that the state's going to take over all of the funding, and we didn't live up to it in 2003, and we didn't live up to it in 2005. So, I'm guessing that, and the governor agrees with my scenario that no state really has 100%. Maintain 100% education funding. And then I think the other one is the one that we heard about today, which is the reliance on referendum to fund essentials, so to speak. And I think that's and I've heard a lot of negative aspects to that, dividing communities, negative campaigns, things like that. And I'm not so sure, I don't have an answer or anything, but I'm not so sure that that's a positive thing in our education system. And if we could look at that as a committee or multiple committees, a tax committee as well, and figure out is there a better way of doing it than charging our districts out there with the charge of get away from splitting communities and dividing groups up and negative campaigns. And I think even at the legislative level, we know how tough that is sometimes and how unavoidable. But I think that education, you know, we could at least make some effort at trying to avoid that. So, Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I still think, though, you're right, with the state, I don't think 100% is the right number for the state, but we do create part of the problem with our disparity from district to district, and that is our problem as a legislature. We do create the problem that Elk River gets $1,000 per student per year, less than the average, not less than the highest. That's less than the average. And so, by the way, we let our formula continue to divide districts, if you will, by funding some students at a far greater rate than others just because they're in a different district. And I don't think all the categories are justifiable. The formula is still a big problem, and the funding gap from district to district is enormous, and I think it's wrong. It doesn't treat students equally. There's justification for some categories, but I think on a state level, I've only been here a short time, and I think we fund schools on a state level by virtue of the squeaky wheel and how much power they're in the legislature from certain areas of the state. And I don't think that's fair to the kids. And so you have districts that literally get thousands of dollars less per year per student than another district, and that's not right. That hurts everybody. I really believe that.
Okay. You know, on that particular point, Senator Wergen, we had this conference down at the History Center, and they were talking about the disparity between, you know, the gap, the education gap, and I forget which presenter talked about, I mean, that we were far below that, the resources to try to address that education gap. And so I think we could look at a better way to address that education gap, and I think all of us realize that it's there. I talked to some superintendents up in my district here the last few weeks, and some of the smallest districts in the state and some of the lowest funded districts in the state are having some of the highest educational achievements. And so I think that the dollars alone are not necessarily the cause of that education gap.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that we don't need resources to address that. I think when we had to cut very deeply into the education surrounding programs a number of years ago, we saw negative results. Communities that were doing well, and then they lost some of these programs that were, quote, not necessarily classroom programs, then they reverted back to, you know, more crime, more truancy, and more, you know, problem students. So I think the landscape is pretty open for us to see how we can improve the outcomes for all of our districts. You have ideas, and Senator Hand has ideas. I think all of us can contribute to that somehow. And Senator Olson and I have had a particular kind of teaming effort for a number of years about technical education, vocational education, and how that has been under tremendous pressure as the budget's gotten ratcheted down and certain standards have gotten ratcheted up. And I personally believe that has had a very big impact on a lot of students. So I think all of us need to contribute our ideas into the pool and obviously figure out how we can get make those things happen.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Warren.
I really want to make sure that I agree with you, because the funding alone is not going to close the gap that we have in achievement. I was at the History Center at that same, the STEM conference, I assume you're referring to. I thought it was absolutely marvelous. I wish every teacher in the state could have been at that conference. I thought it was really valuable. And I'm not meaning that that's going to close that achievement gap by any means, but some of our schools can't make offerings because they're so far below the average. That's where I'm coming from. And two of the speakers at that STEM conference referenced the fact that expectations of certain groups of students would make a lot of difference, too. When we lower the expectations, we get what we ask for. And so I'm hoping some of that changes, too. And I hope that more of the schools and the instructors have an opportunity to hear some of the STEM information that we did.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman, maybe you can answer this. I know Minnesota has for some time been the leader, if not or one of the top ones, in terms of closing that disparity between the 5th and the 95th percentile. But somebody earlier here, I made reference that disparity was growing. Do you know where we stand in relation to other states in terms of the range? Is our range growing broader between the 5th and the 95th percentile?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, this is a Minnesota requirement to make that calculation. I'm not aware that most other states make that similar calculation. Undoubtedly some do. So in terms of across state to states, I'm not sure we'd be able to make those comparisons adequately to give you information. What I can tell you is that in the last 2 or 3 years, if Mr. Melcher here, he'd know it off the top of his head, but our disparity has been growing.
It has.
There was a period at the beginning of the 2000s where we were not growing, and members will know when we're growing because a report will show up under law. If the disparity grows, the Department of Education is required by law to submit a report to you that recommends solutions to reduce that disparity, and I believe that is still in law.
So do you know how far off we are in terms of?
Off the top of my head, Senator Olson, no. I mean the change year to year is not dramatic, but as we, based on what's measured in that report, the more you get referenda and more reliance on referenda, you're getting more deviation from the funding base, and that does create the disparity. And the changes year to year are not huge, but if they go up even a slight tenth of a percent, then they're required to file a report.
But Mr. Chairman, that's revenue. I think we've been also talking about what the formula does, and that would not be a factor of referendum. It would be a factor of what our formula driven. We should know what that is, too, and whether that is, in fact, driving a disparity. I think that's what Senator Wergens was referring to, and I think it could be instructive if we were to see that framed in more than one way.
Well, members, thank you, and all of you, the public, and those who have testified, thank you very much for taking the time and coming here and sharing your information with us. I'm sorry we ran over. Hopefully you'll be able to get something to eat now, and we can see you soon.
Thank you.
The committee is adjourned.
Thank you for doing this, Senator.
You're welcome.
A few minutes late, but I stuck with you to the end.